Chapter 1. Underscore the time of my departure from Castile, and what further happened to me. Underscore. In the year 1514 I departed from Castile in the suite of Pedro Arias de Avila, who had just then been appointed governor of Terra Firma. At sea we had sometimes bad and sometimes good weather, until we arrived at Nombre Dios, where the plague was raging. Of this we lost many of our men, and most of us got terrible sores on our legs, and were otherwise ill. Soon after our arrival, dissensions arose between the governor and a certain wealthy cavalier, named Vasco Núñez de Balboa, who had brought this province to subjection, and was married to one of the daughters of Avila. As, however, suspicion had been excited against him, owing to a plan he had formed of making a voyage to the South Sea at his own expense, for which he required a considerable body of troops, his own father-in-law deposed him and afterwards sentenced him to decapitation. While we were spectators of all this, and saw, moreover, how other soldiers rebelled against their superior officers, we learnt that the island of Cuba had just been conquered, and that a nobleman of Cuellar, named Diego Velasquez, was appointed governor there. Upon this news some of us met together, cavaliers and soldiers, all persons of quality who had come with Pedro Arias de Avila, and asked his permission to proceed to the island of Cuba. This he readily granted, not having sufficient employment for so great a number of men as he had brought with him from Spain. Neither was there any further conquest to be made in these parts, all was in profound peace, so thoroughly had his son-in-law Balboa subdued the country, besides which it was but small in extent and thinly populated. As soon, therefore, as we had obtained leave, we embarked in a good vessel and took our departure. Our voyage was most prosperous, so that we speedily arrived at Cuba. The first thing we did was to pay our respects to the governor, who received us with great kindness, and made us a promise of the first Indians that might be discharged. 3 years, however, passed away since our first arrival in Terra Firma and stay at Cuba, still living in the expectation of the Indians which had been promised us, but in vain. During the whole of this time we had accomplished nothing worthy of notice. We therefore, the 110 who had come from Terra Firma, with some others of Cuba, who were also without any Indians, met together to concert measures with a rich cavalier named Francisco Hernandez de Cordoba, who, besides being a person of wealth, possessed great numbers of Indians on the island. This gentleman we chose for our captain. He was to lead us out on voyages for the discovery of new countries, where we might find sufficient employment. We purchased 3 vessels, 2 of which were of considerable burden. The 3rd was given us by the governor, Diego Velasquez, on condition namely, that we should first invade the Guanajes Islands, which lie between Cuba and the Honduras, and bring him thence 3 cargoes of Indians, whom he wanted for slaves. This he would consider as payment for the vessel. We were, however, fully aware that it was an act of injustice which Diego Velasquez thus required at our hands, and gave him for answer, that neither God nor the king had commanded us to turn a free people into slaves. When he learnt our determination, he confessed that our project for the discovery of new countries was more praiseworthy, and he furnished us with provisions for our voyage. We had now 3 vessels and a sufficient supply of cassava bread, as it is there made from the juca root. We also purchased some pigs, which cost us 3 pesos apiece, for at that time there were neither cows nor sheep on the island of Cuba. To this I must also add a scanty supply of other provisions, while every soldier took with him some glass beads for barter. We had 3 pilots, of whom the principal one, who had the chief command of our vessels, was called Anton de Alaminos, a native of Palos. The 2 others were, Camacho de Triana, and Juan Alvarez el Manquillo of Huelva. In the same way we hired sailors, and furnished ourselves with ropes, anchors, water casks, and other necessaries for our voyage, all at our own expense and personal risk. After we had met together, in all 110, we departed for a harbor on the north coast of Cuba, called by the natives Ajaruco. The distance from this place to the town of San Cristobal, then recently built, was 24 miles, for the Havana had then only been 2 years in our possession. In order that our squadron might not want for anything really useful, we engaged a priest at the town of San Cristobal. His name was Alonso Gonzalez, and by fair words and promises we persuaded him to join us. We also appointed, in the name of His Majesty, a treasurer, called Bernardino Migas, a native of Saint Domingo de la Calzada. This was done in order that if it pleased God we should discover any new countries, where either gold, silver, or pearls were to be found, there might be amongst us a qualified person to take charge of the fifths for the emperor. After everything had been thus properly ordered and we had heard Mass said, we commended ourselves to God, our Lord Jesus Christ, and the Virgin Mary His Blessed Mother, and set out on our voyage, as I shall further relate. Chapter 2. Underscore of the discovery of Yucatan, and the battle we fought there with the natives. Underscore. We sailed in the year 1517 from the harbor of Jaruco and left the Havana. This harbor lies on the north coast of Cuba, and is so called by the natives. After 12 days sail we had passed the coast of St. Antonius, which in Cuba is called the country of the Guanatavis, a wild tribe of Indians. We now made for the wide ocean, steering continually towards the west, totally ignorant of the shoals and currents or of the winds which predominate in this latitude. Certainly most hazardous on our part, and indeed we were very soon visited by a terrible storm, which continued 2 days and two nights, in which the whole of us had nigh perished. After the storm had abated and we had changed our course, we came in sight of land on the 21st day after our departure from Cuba, which filled every heart with joy and thanks towards God. This country had never been discovered before, nor had anyone ever heard of it. From our ships we could perceive a considerable sized town, which lay about 6 miles from the seashore. On account of its magnitude, and because it was larger than any town in Cuba, we gave it the name of underscore Grand Cairo underscore. We resolved that our smallest vessel should near the shore as much as possible, to learn the nature of the spot and look out for a good anchorage. One morning, the 5th of March, we perceived 5 large canoes full of men coming towards us as swift as their paddles and sails could bring them from the town just mentioned. These canoes were hollowed out of the trunks of large trees, after the manner of our kneading troughs. Many of them were big enough to hold from 40 to 50 Indians. As these Indians approached us in their canoes, we made signs of peace and friendship, beckoning at the same time to them with our hands and cloaks to come up to us that we might speak with them, for at that time there was nobody amongst us who understood the language of Yucatan or Mexico. They now came alongside of us without evincing the least fear, and more than 30 of them climbed on board of our principal ship. We gave them bacon and cassava bread to eat, and presented each with a necklace of green glass beads. After they had for some time minutely examined the ship, the chief, who was a cacique, gave us to understand, by signs, that he wished to get down again into his canoe and return home, but that he would come the next day with many more canoes in order to take us on shore. These Indians wore a kind of cloak made of cotton, and a small sort of apron which hung from their hips halfway down to the knee, which they termed maltates. We found them more intelligent than the Indians of Cuba, where only the women wear a similar species of apron made of cotton, which hangs down over their thighs, and is called by them an agua. But to continue my narrative. Very early the morning following, our cacique again called upon us. This time he brought with him 12 large canoes and a number of rowers. He made known to our captain, by signs, that we were good friends and might come to his town. He would give us plenty to eat with everything we wanted, and could go on shore in his 12 canoes. I shall never forget how he said, in his language, underscore con escatic underscore con escatic underscore, which means, come with me to my houses yonder. We therefore called the spot Punta de Catoche, under which name it stands on the sea charts. In consideration of all these friendly invitations from the cacique to accompany him to his village, our captain held a short consultation with us, when we came to the resolution to lower our boats, take the smallest of our vessels with us, and so proceed together with the 12 canoes all at once on shore, as the coast was crowded with Indians from the above-mentioned village. This was accordingly done, and we all arrived there at the same time. The cacique seeing us now landed, but that we made no signs of going to his village, again gave our captain to understand, by signs, that we should follow him to his habitation, making at the same time so many demonstrations of friendship, that a second consultation was held as to whether we should accompany him or not. This was carried in the affirmative, but we took every precaution to be upon our guard, marching in close order with our arms ready for action. We took 15 crossbows with a like number of matchlocks, and followed the cacique, who was accompanied by a great number of Indians. As we were thus marching along, and had arrived in the vicinity of several rocky mountains, the cacique all at once raised his voice, calling aloud to his warriors, who it seemed were lying wait in ambush, to fall upon us and destroy us all. The cacique had no sooner given the signal, than out rushed with terrible fury great numbers of armed warriors, greeting us with such a shower of arrows, that 15 of our men were immediately wounded. These Indians were clad in a kind of cuirass made of cotton, and armed with lances, shields, bows, and slings, with each a tuft of feathers stuck on his head. As soon as they had let fly their arrows, they rushed forward and attacked us man to man, setting furiously to with their lances, which they held in both hands. When, however, they began to feel the sharp edge of our swords, and saw what destruction our crossbows and matchlocks made among them, they speedily began to give way. 15 of their number lay dead on the field. At some distance from the spot where they had so furiously attacked us was a small place in which stood 3 houses built of stone and lime. These were temples in which were found many idols made of clay which were of a pretty good size. Some had the countenances of devils, others those of females, some again had even more horrible shapes, and appeared to represent Indians committing horrible offenses. In these temples we also found small wooden boxes containing other of their gods with hellish faces, several small shells, some ornaments, three crowns, and other trinkets, some in the shape of fish, others in the shape of ducks, all worked out of an inferior kind of gold. Seeing all this, the gold, and the good architectural style of the temples, we felt overjoyed at the discovery of this country, for Peru was not discovered till 16 years after. While we were fighting with the Indians, the priest Gonzalez ordered the gold and small idols to be removed to our ships by two Indians whom we had brought with us from Cuba. During the skirmish we took two of the natives prisoners, who subsequently allowed themselves to be baptized and became Christians. One was named Melchior and the other Julian, both were tattooed about the eyes. The combat with the natives now being at an end, we resolved to re-embark, and prosecute our voyage of discovery further along the coast towards the west. Having dressed the wounds of our men we again set sail. Chapter 3 _ Discovery of the coast of Campeche _ Continuing the course we had previously determined upon, more westward along the coast, we discovered many promontories, bays, reefs, and shallows. We all considered this country to be an island, because our pilot, Anton de Alaminos, persisted in it. During daytime we proceeded with all caution, but lay to at nights. After sailing in this way for 14 days, we perceived another village which appeared to us of considerable magnitude. Here was a bay with an inner harbor, and it appeared to us that there might also be some river or small stream where we could take in fresh water, which latter had become very scarce, as our supply in the casks, which were none of the best, was fast diminishing, for, as the expedition was fitted out solely by persons in poor circumstances, we had not been able to purchase good ones. It happened to be Sunday Lazari when we landed, and we therefore named this place in honor of this day, although we were well aware that the Indians called it the land of _Campeche _. In order that the whole of us might land at the same time, we determined to go on shore in our smallest vessel and three boats, all of us well armed, to be ready in case we should meet with a similar rencontre at the Cape of Catoche. The sea in these bays and roads is very shallow, so that our vessels were forced to anchor at more than 3 miles distance from the shore. Thus precautious we landed near the village, but were still a good way from the place where we intended to fill our casks. From this spot the natives also had their water, for we now found that there was no rivulet in the neighborhood. When we had brought our casks on shore, filled them with water, and were about to embark again, about 50 Indians from the village came up to us. They all wore stately mantles made of cotton, appeared friendly disposed, and to be caciques. They asked us, by signs, what our business was there. We told them to take in water, and that we were about to re-embark. They further pointed with their hands to the rising of the sun, and asked us whether we came from that quarter, at the same time pronouncing the word _Castilian _Castilian _, but at that moment we did not pay any particular attention to the word Castilian. In the course of this interview, however, they gave us to understand that we might go with them to their village. We held a consultation amongst ourselves as to whether we should accept the invitation, and at length unanimously agreed to follow them, but to use the utmost circumspection. They took us to some large edifices, which were strongly put together, of stone and lime, and had otherwise a good appearance. These were temples, the walls of which were covered with figures representing snakes and all manner of gods. Round about a species of altar we perceived several fresh spots of blood. On some of the idols there were figures like crosses, with other paintings representing groups of Indians. All this astonished us greatly as we had neither seen nor heard of such things before. It appeared to us that the inhabitants had just been sacrificing some Indians to their gods, to obtain from them the power to overcome us. There were great numbers of Indians with their wives who received us with pleasing smiles, and otherwise made every show of friendship, but their numbers gradually increasing we began to entertain fears that it would end in the same hostile manner as at Cape Catoche. While we were thus looking on, a number of Indians approached us clad in tattered cloaks, each carrying a bundle of dried reeds, which they arranged in order on the ground. Among them we also perceived two troops of men armed with bows, lances, shields, slings, and stones, having their cotton cuirasses on. At the head of these, and at some distance from us stood the chiefs. At this moment 10 Indians came running out of another temple, all dressed in long white robes, while the thick hair of their heads was so entangled and clotted with blood that it would have been an impossibility to have combed or put it in order without cutting it off. These personages were priests, and in New Spain are commonly termed _papas_. 2, I repeat it, that in New Spain they are termed papas, and I will therefore in future call them by that name. These papas brought with them a kind of incense, which looked like resin, and is termed by them copal. They had pans made of clay filled with glowing embers, and with these they perfumed us. They also gave us to understand, by signs, that we should leave their country before the bundles of reeds, which had been brought and were going to be set fire to, should be consumed, otherwise they would attack and kill us every man. Upon this they ordered the bundles to be lighted, and as soon as they began to burn, all were silent, nor did they utter another syllable. Those, on the contrary, who had ranged themselves in order of battle, began to play on their pipes, blow their twisted shells, and beat their drums. When we saw what their real intentions were, and how confident they appeared, it of course reminded us that our wounds which we had received at Cape Catoche were not yet healed, that two of our men had died of the consequences, whom we had been obliged to throw overboard. As the number of Indians continued to increase, we became alarmed, and resolved to retreat to the shore in the best order we could. In this way we marched along the coast until we arrived at that spot where our boats and the small vessels lay with the water casks. Not far distant from this place stood a rock in the midst of the sea, for, on account of the vast numbers of Indians, we durst not venture to re-embark where we had at first landed, as they would no doubt have fallen upon us while we were getting into our boats. After we had thus managed to get our water safe on board and re-embark at the small harbor which the bay here forms, we continued our course for 6 days and 6 nights without interruption, the weather being very fine. But now the wind suddenly veered round to the north and brought stormy weather, as is always the case with a north wind on this coast. The storm lasted 24 hours, and indeed we had nearly all of us met with a watery grave, so boisterous was the sea. In order to save ourselves from total destruction we cast anchor near the shore. The safety of our ship now depended upon two ropes, and had they given way we should have been cast on shore. Oh, in what a perilous situation we were then placed! Had we been torn away from our anchors we must have been wrecked off the coast. But it was the will of Providence that our old ropes and cables should preserve us. When the storm had abated we continued our course along the coast and kept in as much as possible, that we might take in water when required. For, as I have before stated, our casks were old and leaky, nor was the best economy used with the water, for we thought by going on shore we should be certain either to meet with some spring or obtain it by digging wells. Thus coasting along we espied a village from our ships, and about 3 miles further on there was a kind of inner harbor, at the head of which it appeared to us there might be some river or brook, we therefore resolved to land here. The water, as I have above mentioned, being uncommonly shallow along this coast, we were compelled to anchor our two larger vessels at about 3 miles distance from the shore, fearing they might otherwise run aground. We then proceeded with our smallest vessel and all our boats in order to land at the above mentioned inner harbor. We were, however, quite upon our guard, and carried along with us, besides the water casks, our arms, crossbows, and muskets. It was about midday when we landed. The distance from here to the village, which was called Patuncan, might be 3 miles. Here we found some wells, maize plantations, and stone buildings. Our water casks were soon filled, but we could not succeed to get them into our boats on account of an attack made upon us by great numbers of the inhabitants. I will, however, break off here and relate the battle we fought, in the next chapter. Chapter 4. _ How we landed in a bay close to some maize plantations, near the harbor of Patuncan, and of the attack that was made upon us there. _ While we were busy taking in water, near the above mentioned houses and maize plantations, great numbers of Indians were making towards us from the village of Patuncan, as it is termed by the natives. They had all their cotton cuirasses on, which reached to their knees, and were armed with bows, lances, shields, and swords. The latter were shaped like our broadswords, and are wielded with both hands. They also had slings and stones, their bunches of feathers on, and their whole bodies painted with white, brown, and black colors. They approached us in profound silence, as if they came with the most peaceable intentions, and inquired of us by signs if we came from the rising of the sun, thereby pronouncing the very same words which the inhabitants of St. Lázaro had used, namely, _ Castilian, Castilian_. We told them, likewise by signs, that we indeed came from the rising of the sun. We certainly did not understand what they meant, nevertheless it was something for us to reflect on, while it at the same time gave rise to a variety of conjectures, since the natives of St. Lázaro had used the identical words. It was about the hour of Ave Maria, when the Indians approached us in this manner. A few country houses were scattered round about the neighborhood. We took the precaution to post watches in different quarters, and upon the whole kept a sharp lookout, as the manner in which the natives were assembling seemed to forebode very little good. When we had closed our ranks and taken every necessary precaution, our ears were assailed by the cries and yells of large bodies of Indians who were advancing from different quarters. As they were all armed for battle, we could no longer doubt that some evil design was lurking behind. We therefore held a consultation with our captain as to the course we should adopt. Many were of opinion that the best we could do would be to re-embark ourselves in all haste, but, as is always the case in critical moments, one advised this and another that, and so this proposal was overruled as unadvisable, for the vast numbers of Indians would certainly fall upon us while we were getting into our boats and we should all stand in danger of being killed. Others again, among which number I also was, were of opinion that the enemy should be attacked that very night, for, according to the old saying, he who strikes the first blow remains master of the field, but we might make up our minds that each of us singly would have to encounter 30 Indians at least. Day now began to dawn, and we emboldened each other to meet the coming severe conflict by putting our trust in God and commending our cause to Him, while everyone was determined to defend himself to the utmost. As soon as daylight had fully broken forth, we perceived more troops of armed natives moving towards the coast with flying colors. They had on their feather knots, and were provided with drums, bows, lances, shields, and joined themselves to the others who had arrived in the night. They divided themselves into different bodies, surrounded us on all sides, and commenced pouring forth such showers of arrows, lances, and stones, that more than 80 of our men were wounded at the first onset. They next rushed furiously forward and attacked us man to man, some with their lances, others with their swords and arrows, and all this with such terrible fury that we were compelled also to show them earnest. We dealt many a good thrust and blow amongst them, keeping up at the same time an incessant fire with our muskets and crossbows, for while some loaded others fired. At last, by dint of heavy blows and thrusts we forced them to give way, but they did not retreat further than was necessary, in order that they might still continue to hem us in all safety, constantly crying out in their language, _Alkalashoni_, which signifies, kill the chief. And sure enough our captain was wounded in no less than 12 different places by their arrows. I myself had 3, one of which was in my left side and very dangerous, the arrow having pierced to the very bone. Others of our men were wounded by the enemy's lances, and 2 were carried off alive, of whom, one was called Alonzo Boat, the other was an old Portuguese. Perceiving how closely we were hemmed in on all sides by the enemy, who not only kept constantly pouring in fresh troops but were copiously supplied on the field of battle with meat, drink, and quantities of arrows, we soon concluded that all our courageous fighting would not advance us a step. The whole of us were wounded, many shot through the neck, and more than 50 of our men were killed. In this critical situation we determined to cut our way manfully through the enemy's ranks and make for the boats, which fortunately lay on the coast near at hand. We therefore firmly closed our ranks and broke through the enemy. At that moment you should have heard the whizzing of their arrows, the horrible yell they set up, and how the Indians provoked each other to the combat, at the same time making desperate thrusts with their lances. But a still more serious misfortune awaited us, for as we made a simultaneous rush to our boats, they soon sunk or capsized, so that we were forced to cling to them as well as we could, and in this manner by swimming we strove to make the best of our way to the small vessel, which was now in all haste coming up to our assistance. Many of our men were even wounded while climbing into the vessel, but more particularly those who clung to its side, for the Indians pursued us in their canoes and attacked us without intermission. With the greatest exertions and help of God we thus got out of the hands of this people. After we had gained our vessels we found that 57 of our men were missing, besides the 2 whom the Indians had carried off alive, and 5 whom we had thrown overboard, who had died in consequence of their wounds and extreme thirst. The battle lasted a little longer than half an hour. The spot where it took place was certainly called Patonkin. Our seamen, however, gave it the name of Bahia de Malapalaya, the Bay of the Disastrous Engagement, as it stands on the maps. As soon as we found ourselves in safety we returned thanks to Almighty God for the preservation of our lives. Our wounded, however, had still great sufferings to undergo, as we had nothing but salt water to wash their wounds with, which caused them to swell very much. Some of our men swore most bitterly against our chief pilot Alaminos, and the conduct he had pursued, he having steadfastly maintained that this was an island and not a continent. I must, however, break off here, and relate what further happened to us, in the next chapter. Chapter 5. _We resolved to return to Cuba. The extreme thirst we suffered, and all the fatigues we underwent until our arrival in the port of Havana. _After we had got into our vessels, as above related, and returned thanks to God for our preservation, we commenced dressing our wounds. None of us had escaped without 2, 3, or 4 wounds. Our captain had as many as 12, and there was only one single soldier who came off whole. We therefore determined to return to Cuba, but as most of the sailors who had accompanied us on shore were also wounded, we had not sufficient hands to work the sails, we were therefore forced to set fire to our smallest vessel and leave it to the mercy of the waves, after taking out all the ropes, sails, and anchors, and distributing the sailors, who were not wounded equally among the two other vessels. We had, however, to struggle with another far greater evil. This was our great want of fresh water, for although we had filled our barrels and casks near Patonkin, we did not succeed to bring them off, owing to the furious attack of the natives and the hurry we were in to get on board, thus we had been compelled to leave them behind and return without a single drop of water. We suffered most intensely from thirst, and the only way we could in some measure refresh our parched tongues was to hold the edges of our axes between our lips. Oh, what a fearful undertaking it is to venture out on the discovery of new countries, and place one's life in danger, as we were obliged to do. Those alone can form any idea of it who have gone through the hard school of experience. We now kept as close into the shore as possible, to look out for some stream or creek where we might meet with fresh water. After thus continuing our course for 3 days, we espied an inlet or mouth of some river as we thought, and set a few hands on shore in the hopes of meeting with water. These were 15 sailors who had remained on board during the battle at Patonkin, and 3 soldiers who had been only slightly wounded. They carried along with them pickaxes and 3 small casks. But the water in the inlet was salt, and wherever they dug wells it was equally bad. They nevertheless filled the casks with it, but it was so bitter and salty as to be unfit for use. 2 soldiers who drank of it became ill of the consequences. The water here swarmed with lizards, we therefore gave this place the name of Lizard Bay, under which name it stands on the sea charts. But, to continue my history, I must not forget to mention that while our boats were on shore in search of water, there suddenly arose such a violent tempest from the northeast, that our ships were nigh being cast on shore. For, as we were forced to lay to, the wind blowing hard from the north and northeast, our position was extremely dangerous, from a scarcity of ropes. When the men who had gone on shore with our boats perceived the danger we were in, they hastened to our assistance, and cast out additional anchors and cables. In this way we lay for 2 days and 2 nights. After the expiration of that time we again heaved our anchors and steered in the direction of Cuba. Our pilot Alaminos here held a consultation with the 2 others, when they concluded that the best plan would be to get, if possible, into the latitude of Florida, which, according to their charts and furthest measurement, could not be more than 210 miles distant, for they assured us if we could get into the latitude of Florida, we should have a better and speedier sail to the Havana. It turned out exactly as they had said, for Alaminos had been in these parts before, having accompanied Juan de Leon when he discovered Florida, about 10 or 12 years previously. After 4 days' sail we crossed this gulf and came in sight of Florida. Chapter 6 _ How 20 of us went on shore in the Bay of Florida with the pilot Alaminos in search of water, the hostilities which the natives of this country commenced with us, and of all that further befell us on our passage to the Havana. _ As soon as we had arrived off the coast of Florida we determined that 20 of our men, who had almost recovered from their wounds, should go on shore. Among the number was myself and the pilot, Alaminos. We each took a mattock and a small cask, being, moreover, well armed with crossbows and muskets. Our captain, who was dangerously wounded and very much weakened by the extreme thirst he suffered, begged of us, in the name of God, to bring him some sweet water, as he was almost dying of thirst. Indeed, the water, as I have before said, which we then had was quite salty and not drinkable. We landed in a creek, and our pilot again recognized this coast, which he had visited 10 or 12 years previously with Ponce de Leon, when he discovered these countries. They had here fought a battle with the natives, and lost many of their men. We therefore took every precaution lest the natives should also fall upon us unawares. We posted 2 sentinels at a spot where the stream had a considerable breadth. We then dug deep wells where we thought fresh water was likely to be found. The sea was just ebbing, and it pleased God that we should find sweet water there. With joyful hearts we then took our fill of the refreshing beverage, and washed the bandages of our wounded. A good hour's time was spent in this, and as we were on the point of re-embarking with the casks of water, quite overjoyed at our success, one of the men whom we had placed sentinel on the coast came running towards us in all haste, crying aloud, "To arms! To arms! Numbers of Indians are approaching, both by land and sea." And indeed the Indians came up to us almost at the same time with the sentinel. They had immense-sized bows with sharp arrows, lances, and spears. Among these some were shaped like swords while their large powerful bodies were covered with skins of wild beasts. They made straight ways to us, let fly their arrows, and wounded 6 of our men at the first onset. I was also slightly wounded in my right arm. We, however, received our enemies with such well-directed blows and musket shots that they very soon quitted us who had been digging the wells, and turned towards the creek to assist their companions who in their canoes were attacking those left behind in the boat. The latter had been forced to fight man to man, and had already lost the boat, which the Indians were towing off behind their canoes. Four of the sailors had been wounded, and the pilot, Alaminos, himself severely so in the throat. We, however, courageously faced our enemy, went up to our middles in the water, and soon compelled them, by dint of our swords, to jump out of the boat again. 22 of the enemy lay dead on the shore, 3 others, who were slightly wounded, we took on board with us, but they died soon after. After this skirmish was ended, we questioned the soldier who had stood sentinel as to what had become of his companion, Brio. He related that his comrade had left him with an axe in his hand, in order to go and cut down a palm tree, and that this was near the inlet where the Indians first made their appearance. He had also heard him cry out in Spanish, upon which he himself had immediately hastened to give us the information. His companion, no doubt, had been murdered by the Indians. Singular that this man should have lost his life here, he being the only one who escaped without a wound at the Battle of Petonkin. We made every search for him, and followed the track of the Indians who had just attacked us. This indeed led us to a palm tree which had been recently cut, around which were numerous footmarks. We could, however, discover no marks of blood, and concluded, therefore, that the Indians had carried off the man alive. After we had fruitlessly searched for him in every quarter for upwards of an hour, and repeatedly called out aloud to him, without receiving any answer, we returned to our boat, and brought the water on board. The joy of our men was as great as if we had brought them new life, and one of the soldiers, from excessive thirst, leapt from the vessel into the boat, seized one of the small casks, and poured such an abundance of water into his body, that he instantaneously swelled out and expired. Having brought the water on board our vessels, hauled in our boats, we hoisted our sails and stood direct for the Havana. The day and following night the weather was most beautiful as we passed the Martyr Islands and sandbanks of the same name. We had only 4 fathoms water, where the sea was deepest, our principal ship consequently struck against the rocks and became very leaky, so that all hands were engaged at the pumps, without then being able to get the water under, while we every moment feared the vessel would go down. I never shall forget the answer which some sailors from the Levant, who were among the crew, made when we cried out to them, "Come on, my boys, help us to pump out the water, or we shall all be lost. You see how our wounds and hard labor have debilitated us." "That's your own lookout," said they, "we get no pay, suffer both from hunger and thirst, and have, in the bargain, to share your fatigues and wounds." Nothing now remained but to drive them to the pumps by main force, and in this way we had alternately to work the sails and the pumps, however distasteful to us, until the Lord Jesus brought us into the port of Carina, where now the town of Havana stands, the latter being previously called Porto de Carinas, and not the Havana. As soon as we had set foot on shore we returned thanks to the Almighty for our safe return, and got the water out of our principal ship, in which a Portuguese diver, who happened to be on board another vessel, greatly assisted us. We also immediately wrote to the governor, Diego Velasquez, giving him an account of the countries we discovered with large townships and houses built of stone, whose inhabitants were clad in cotton, and wore maltates, likewise of the gold and the regular maize plantations of the country. Our captain journeyed overland to San Espiritus, where he had his Indian commandery. He died, however, 10 days after his arrival there, from his wounds. The rest of our men became dispersed through the island, and 3 more of our men died of their wounds at the Havana. Our vessels were taken to Santiago de Cuba, where the governor resided. Here the 2 Indians were brought on shore whom we had taken with us from the Punta de Catoche, as above related, called Mel Carrillo and Julianillo. When, however, we brought forth the box with the crowns, the golden ducks, the fish, and the idols, more noise was made about them than they really merited, so that they became the common topics of conversation throughout the islands of Saint Domingo and Cuba. Indeed the fame thereof even reached Spain. There it was said that none of the countries which had hitherto been discovered were as rich as this, and in none had there been found houses built of stone. The earth and gods, it was said, were the remains of the ancient heathen times. Others again went so far as to affirm that they were descendants of the Jews whom Titus and Vespasian had driven from Jerusalem, who had been shipwrecked off this coast. Peru, indeed, was not then known, and in so far the countries we had discovered were justly considered of the greatest importance. Diego Velasquez closely questioned the 2 Indians as to whether there were any gold mines in their country. They answered in the affirmative, and when they were shown some of the gold dust found in the island of Cuba, they said there was abundance of it in their country. In this they told an untruth, as it is very well known there are neither gold mines on the Punta de Catoche nor even in whole Yucatan. They were likewise shown the beds in which the seeds of that plant are sown, from whose root the cassava bread is made, and in Cuba called yuca. They assured us that the same plant grew in their country, and was called by them tail. As the cassava root at Cuba is called yuca, and the ground in which it is planted by the Indians dale, so from these two words arose the name of the country, Yucatan. For the Spaniards who were standing around the governor at the time he was speaking to the two Indians said, "You see, sir, they call their country Yucatan." And from this circumstance the country retained the name of Yucatan, although the natives call it otherwise. In this beautiful voyage of discovery we had spent our all, and returned to Cuba covered with wounds, and as poor as beggars, yet we had reason to congratulate ourselves that it had not been equally disastrous to us all as to many of our companions who had lost their lives. Our captain, as I have already mentioned, died soon after his return, and all of us suffered for a considerable time after from our wounds. Our whole loss amounted to 70 men, which was all we had gained by this voyage of discovery. Concerning all this the governor Diego Velasquez wrote to those gentlemen in Spain who at that time managed the affairs of India, and boasted of the discoveries had made, and of the vast expense it had put to. This actually obtained credit, and the Bishop of Burgos, Don Juan Rodriguez de Fonseca, who also bore the title of Archbishop of Rosano, and was President of Indian Affairs, wrote in that strain to His Majesty, in Flanders, vastly extolling the merit of Diego Velasquez, at the same time not as much as even mentioning the names of any of us who had really discovered the country. I will, however, break off here, and relate in the following chapter what further fatigues I and three more of my companions in arms had to undergo. Chapter 7. _ The fatigues I had to undergo, until my arrival in the town of Trinidad. _ I have already above related that I with some other soldiers who had not quite recovered from our wounds remained behind in the Havana. As soon as the latter began to heal a little we three made up our minds to go in company with a certain Pedro de Villa, an inhabitant of the Havana, to the town of Trinidad. This man was going to make a voyage in a canoe along the south coast, and had taken a lading of cotton shirts, which he intended to dispose of in Trinidad. As I have above stated, these canoes are hollowed out of the trunks of trees, after the manner of our baker's troughs. In this country they are used for coasting, and we had to pay Pedro de Villa 10 doubloons for the voyage. As we were coasting along, sometimes rowing, sometimes sailing, we arrived after the 11th day in sight of an Indian village, subject to the Spaniards, and called Canarion. There arose at night time such a terrible gale of wind, that, although we rowed with all our strength, we could not keep the sea any longer. Notwithstanding every exertion of Pedro de Villa, of some Indians from the Havana, and several other good rowers we had with us, nothing at last remained but to run the canoe aground between the steep rocks. The canoe was dashed to pieces, the whole lading of Pedro de Villa went to the bottom, and we made the best of our way on shore, naked as the day we were born, our bodies cut and bruised all over by clambering over the rocks, for we had stripped ourselves of our clothes in order to be the better able to swim, and also, if possible, to save the canoe. As we had only escaped with our lives among these rocks, none other choice was left us than to continue our road over them to Trinidad, which lay along the coast through a barren country full of rugged rocks, where our feet soon became blistered and wounded, as to think of getting anything to eat was quite out of the question, while we had continually to struggle with a terrific gale of wind and the sea breaking over the rocks. Although we had not neglected to cover our bodies as much as possible with leaves and herbs, we nevertheless got sore boils between our legs, which bled very much. At last we could proceed no further, for the sharp stones had covered our feet with wounds. We managed, however, with considerable trouble to reach a more elevated spot. None of us having his sword left, we contrived by means of sharp stones to loosen the bark of some trees and bind it as well as we could under the soles of our feet, with the tendrils of climbers, which grew among the wood. And in this way, after suffering great fatigues we reached a sandy district on the coast, whence in a couple of days we arrived in the Indian village Yarama, at that time the property of Bartholomew de las Casas, 3, who was a priest. I knew him afterwards when he belonged to the order of the Dominicans, and became bishop of Quiopia. Here the Indians gave us to eat, and on the following day we arrived at another village, called Chipiona, which was the joint property of Alonso de Villa, and of Sandoval, but this was not the captain of the same name who gained such vast renown in New Spain. From this place we at last came to Trinidad, where I had an acquaintance, by name Antonio de Medina, who provided me with a suit of clothes as they were worn in that town. My comrades were similarly provided by other of the inhabitants. Quite worn out by fatigue and miserably poor, I set off for Santiago de Cuba, where the governor Diego Velasquez resided. He was just then busily engaged fitting out another squadron, and was highly delighted at seeing me again when I called upon him, for we were related to each other, and as one word led to another, he asked me if my wounds were sufficiently healed to make another trip to Yucatan? I could not help smiling at this and said, "Who gave the country that name? For the natives do not call it so. So Melchior, whom you brought with you, calls it," resumed he. "Call it rather," said I, "the land where they killed one half of our men and wounded the other." "Well," said he, "if you have undergone many fatigues, you have only shared the same fate with all others who have ventured out on the discovery of new countries. But, on the other hand, you will not fail to be highly honored and rewarded by His Majesty the King, to whom I will transmit a faithful account of all this. Therefore, my friend, you may in all safety join yourself to the squadron I am now fitting out, and I will take care that you shall have an honorable post." What further happened I will next relate. Chapter 8 _ How Diego Velasquez, Governor of Cuba, set out another armament to the country we had discovered. _ It was in the year of our Lord 1518, after Diego Velasquez had learnt the good account we gave of the newly discovered country, called Yucatan, that he determined to send thither another expedition. For this purpose he selected four vessels, among which were the two in which we warriors had accompanied Cordoba on our recent voyage to Yucatan, purchased at our own expense. At the time this squadron was fitting out there were staying at Santiago de Cuba, Juan de Grijalva, Pedro de Alvarado, Francisco de Montejo, and Alonso de Avila, who had commanderies of Indians in these islands, and had come to transact business with the governor. As these were all men of courage and energy, Velasquez soon made arrangements with them to take part in this expedition, on the following terms: that Juan de Grijalva, who was related to him, should have the chief command of the whole expedition as captain general, while Pedro de Alvarado, Francisco de Montejo, and Alonso de Avila, should be appointed to the command of the three other ships. They had also to furnish the vessels with provisions of cassava bread and pickled meat. Diego Velasquez had, on the other hand, to procure the four vessels, furnish the necessary crossbows, muskets, goods for barter, and other matters of less importance. Our account that the houses in the newly discovered country were built of stone and lime, had spread a vast idea of its riches, added to which the Indian Melcarejo had given to understand by signs that it abounded in gold mines. All this created a great desire among the inhabitants and soldiers throughout the island, who possessed no commanderies of Indians, to go in quest of such a rich country. Consequently, in a very short time, we mustered 220. Each person, moreover, furnished himself with additional provisions, arms, and other matters which might be useful. Thus I again took my departure for that country, under the same commanders I subsequently once more visited it. The instructions which our commanders received from Diego Velasquez were to this effect, that they should barter for as much gold and silver as they could get, and if they deemed it advisable settle colonies, but left this entirely to their own judgment. A person of the name of Penalosa accompanied us in the capacity of comptroller, for priest we had a certain one Diaz. We had also the same three pilots who accompanied us on our former voyage, and a fourth, whose name I do not remember. Each had charge of one of the vessels, but the first in command, as chief pilot, was Anton de Alaminos. But before I proceed with my narrative, I must here remark, that it is not for want of deference on my part, that I barely give the names of the noblemen who were our commanding officers, without adding their titles and describing their several escutcheons, but shall simply call them thus: Pedro de Alvarado, Francisco de Montejo, and Alonso de Avila. I therefore now take this opportunity of saying, that Pedro de Alvarado was a bold cavalier, who, subsequent to the conquest of New Spain, became governor and chief justice of the provinces of Guatemala, Honduras, and Quiapo, and comptroller of Santiago. In like manner Francisco de Montejo, a man of great courage, subsequently was governor and chief justice of Yucatan. I shall merely call them by their proper names, up to that time when His Majesty conferred on them honorary titles and sovereign authority. But to return to my subject, our four vessels lay in the harbor of Matanza on the north coast, not far from the old Havana, which at that time was not built where it now stands. In this harbor, or at least in its neighborhood, most of the inhabitants had their stores of cassava bread and pickled meat. Here consequently our vessels were provided with everything they further required. This place moreover had been appointed the rendezvous for all the officers and men. But, before I continue my narrative, I will explain how this harbor obtained the name of Matanza, for, though it may seem rather out of place here, yet, as so many persons have asked me how it originated, there is some excuse. Some time ago, when Cuba was not quite subdued, It happened that a vessel, bound from the island of St. Domingo to the Lucas, during a heavy storm, was wrecked off the coast. This took place near the river and harbor of Matanza. There were 30 Spaniards and 2 Spanish ladies on board. In order to convey them across the river, numbers of Indians have collected together from the Havana and other districts. They appeared most friendly inclined, and offered to carry the shipwrecked across in their canoes and take them to their habitations, where they would give them to eat. The Spaniards accepted this offer. When the Indians, however, had arrived in the midst of the stream, they upset their canoes and drowned them all, save 3 of the men and 1 of the females. The men were allotted to the other Indians, but the female, a very beautiful woman, was given to the most powerful of the caciques, the person who had concocted this piece of treachery. From this circumstance it was that the harbor got the name of Matanza. I was personally acquainted with the female whose misfortune I have just related. After the total conquest of Cuba, she left the cacique in whose power she then was, and married a citizen of Trinidad, by name Pedro Sanchez Farsan. I was also acquainted with the 3 Spaniards whose lives had been spared. One was Gonzalo Mejia, an old man, and native of Caceres, the other, Juan de Sanis Taban, from Madrigal, and the third was Cascoro, a sailor and fisherman, of Huelva. The cacique in whose power he was, had given him his daughter in marriage, and bored holes through his ears and nose, after the Indian fashion. Having thus detained the reader for a while with these old stories, it is time I return to the thread of my narrative. On the 5th of April, 1518, all of us having met together, the officers and soldiers, the pilots made acquainted with the signals, and the hour of departure fixed, we attended Mass with fervent devotion, and weighed anchor. After 10 days' sail, we passed the Cape of Guaniganico, called by the sailors San Anton. 8 days after, we came in sight of the island of Cozumel. It happened to be the Feast of the Holy Cross. This time our ships were carried further off by the currents than the time before under Cordoba. The consequence was that we now landed on the south coast of the island. We here espied a village, and found a good anchorage near it, perfectly free from all rocks. Our commander-in-chief, therefore, went on shore here with a good body of soldiers. The inhabitants, who had never witnessed such a sight before, immediately took to flight when they saw our vessels approaching, so that not a single one of them had remained in the village. At length we discovered 2 Indians among the recently cut maize plants, who had not been able to get off quick enough. We brought them into the presence of our captain, who spoke to them with the help of Julianillo and Melcarejo, whom we had captured at the Punta de Catoche, and who understood their language. The distance between their countries was only 4 hours' sail, which accounts for the inhabitants of Cozumel speaking the same language. Our commander was very kind to them, gave each some green glass beads, and sent them away to bring the Calachoni of the district, so the caciques are termed here. They, however, never returned. While we were still waiting for them, an Indian woman came towards us, comely in appearance, and who spoke the language of Jamaica. She told us that the Indians had fled, out of fear, to the mountains. As I myself and many others among us understood her language, which is the same as that of the island of Cuba, we were quite astonished at the circumstance, and inquired of her how she had got here. She told us that, 2 years ago, she had left Jamaica with 10 Indians, in a large canoe, in order to go fishing among the islands in this neighborhood, but had been driven on shore by the currents, when the inhabitants killed her husband with most of her companions, and sacrificed them to their gods. It struck our commander, as soon as he had learnt this, that the woman might be employed as a negotiator. He therefore desired her to go and fetch the inhabitants and cacique of the district, and gave her 2 days to return in. We durst not send Melcarejo and Julianillo with her, lest they should run away and return to their own country. The day following, the Indian woman returned, but informed us that, notwithstanding all her representations, she could neither persuade the Indians nor their wives to accompany her. We called this place Santa Cruz, because we had discovered it 4 or 5 days before the Feast of the Holy Cross. In this neighborhood there was plenty of honey, manioc, patat, and large herds of musk swine, which have their navels on their backs. 5. This island contains 3 poor villages, of which the one I am now speaking of is the largest. The 2 smaller ones were both situated on a promontory at about 6 miles distance from each other. Our commander Grijalva, perceiving that it was mere loss of time to make any further stay here, gave orders for re-embarking. The Indian woman of Jamaica went along with us, and we continued our voyage. Chapter 9 _ How we landed at Champoton. From this point we sailed in the same direction we had taken under Cordoba, and arrived after 8 days' sail off the coast of Champoton, the place where the Indians had so ill-used us, as has been related in the proper place. The sea being very shallow in these parts, we dropped our anchor at about 3 miles distance from the shore, and immediately landed in all our boats with half of our men, as near to the village as possible. The inhabitants and other Indians in the neighborhood gathered themselves together as they had the time before, when they killed 56 of our men and wounded all the rest of us. From their bearing and proud demeanor, we could easily perceive that they had not forgotten their victory. They were all well armed according to their fashion, with bows, lances, shields, and broadswords, which they wield with both hands. Added to all this, they had slings, cotton cuirasses, drums and trumpets, while most of them had their faces painted black and white. They had arranged themselves along the seashore in order to fall upon us as soon as we landed. But, as our previous loss had taught us prudence, we took with us this time some falconets, and otherwise well armed ourselves with crossbows and matchlocks. When we were near enough, they let fly such a shower of arrows and lances that the half of our men were speedily wounded. As soon, however, as we got on shore, we quickly gave them an evil return with our matchlocks and sabers. Nothing daunted by this, they each selected their man, whom they particularly aimed at with their arrows, but we had taken the precaution to put on cotton cuirasses. They continued to combat with us for some time, until the arrival of another of our long boats, when we drove them back to the wells near the village. In this conflict we lost one Dequitra and many other soldiers. Our commander, Juan de Grijalva, got 3 arrow wounds and lost 2 of his teeth, and above 60 of our men were wounded. Immediately upon our putting the enemy to flight, we entered the village, dressed our wounds, and buried the dead. Not a single person had remained behind in the village, and even those whom we had driven back to the wells had merely stayed there a sufficient time to carry off their property. In this skirmish we made 3 prisoners, one of whom was a person of rank. Our commander set them at liberty, desiring them to go and call the cacique of the district. He also presented them with green glass beads and small bells to distribute among the inhabitants, in order to gain their friendship. We treated the 3 prisoners upon the whole with every kindness, and gave them glass corals to encourage them and gain their good faith. They left us indeed, but took good care not to return. We thought it possible, however, that Julianillo and Melcarejo had misrepresented our commission to them. We stayed 4 days in this place, and I shall never forget it on account of the immense size locusts which we saw here. It was a stony spot on which the battle took place, and these creatures, while it lasted, kept continually flying in our faces, and as at the same moment we were greeted by a shower of arrows from the enemy, we also mistook these locusts for arrows. But, as soon as we had discovered our mistake, we deceived ourselves in another more direful way, for we now mistook arrows for locusts, and discontinued to shield ourselves against them. In this way we mistook locusts and arrows to our great sorrow, were severely wounded in consequence, and otherwise found ourselves in a very awkward predicament. Chapter 10. We continued our course and ran into Terminos Bay, as we named it. On our further voyage we came to an opening on the coast, which to us appeared to be the mouth of some broad and large river. It was, however, not a river as we had supposed, but a good harbor, which reached so far inland, and had such a considerable breadth, that it appeared like a sea, and our pilot Anton de Olaminos confidently asserted that this was an island whose 2 promontories reached nigh to the continent. We, therefore, termed this opening the Boca de Terminos, under which name it may be found on the sea charts. Our commander and the other officers went on shore here with the greater part of our men, among which number I also was. We remained 3 whole days in this place in order thoroughly to explore the opening and sail through it in all directions. We discovered, however, that it was no island, but a deep indented bay, formed by the continent, affording us a most commodious harbor. As we also found temples here built of stone and lime, full of idols made of wood or clay, with other figures, sometimes representing women, sometimes serpents, also horns of various kinds of wild animals, we concluded that an Indian village must be near at hand. We considered, moreover, that this would be a most excellent spot to found a colony. We had, however, deceived ourselves in one thing, the district being quite uninhabited. The temples most probably belonged to merchants and hunters, who on their journeys most likely ran into this harbor and there made their sacrifices. Fallow deer and rabbits abounded in this neighborhood, and with 1 greyhound only we killed 10 of the former and great numbers of the latter. Our dog took such a liking to this spot that it ran away while we were busy re-embarking, nor did we see it again until we visited this place subsequently with Cortes, when it appeared in excellent condition, quite plump and sleeky. Having thoroughly explored Terminos Harbor, and sounded it throughout, we pursued our course along the coast to the River Tabasco, which at present, after the name of its discoverer, is called the River Grijalva. Chapter 11. How we came into the Tabasco River, which we termed the Grijalva, and what happened to us there. Underscore. As we thus by day sailed along the coast of the continent, for at night we lay to on account of the shallows and rocks, we perceived on the third morning a very broad mouth of some river. We approached the shore as near as possible, thinking we should find a good harbor here. As we came closer to the mouth we saw that the waves broke over its shallows. We consequently lowered our boats to make soundings, and found that our two larger vessels could not come in here. It was therefore immediately resolved that they should anchor further out at sea, but that the two remaining vessels which did not draw so much water, with all our boats well manned, should proceed up the river. We could perceive in the canoes along the shore numbers of Indians with bows and arrows, and in other respects armed exactly like those of Champotone. We concluded from their numbers that a village could not be far off. We also found as we proceeded further up the river along the banks, basket kittles put out, from two of which we took the fish and placed them in a boat astern of our principal ship. This river was previously called after the cacique of the district, the Tabasco. As we, however, discovered it during this expedition, we gave it the name of the Grijalva River, in honor of our chief commander, under which name it stands on the sea charts. We might still have been about 2 miles from the village when we distinctly heard the crackling noise of the felling of trees, for the Indians were constructing barricades and making other preparations of war against us, of the issue of which they entertained no doubts, as they had been duly advertised of the occurrence at Patoncan. As soon as we learnt this, we disembarked our men on a projecting point of land, about 2 miles from the village, where some palm trees were growing. As soon as they perceived this, about 50 canoes with Indians completely armed after their fashion made towards us, while many other canoes, manned in the same way, lay dispersed about the haven, at a greater distance, not daring to approach us so near as the first. Seeing how ready they were for action, we were just upon the point of firing off our great guns, and giving them a volley of musket shots, when it entered our minds, through a merciful providence, that we ought first to try if we could not gain their friendship. We therefore by means of Julianillo and Melcarejo, who were natives of the Punta de Catoche, and certainly understood the language spoken here, told the chiefs they had nothing to fear from us, we were desirous of discoursing with them and had things to disclose, which, as soon as they had learned, would make our arrival pleasing to them. They should come to us and we would gladly give them of the things we had brought. Upon this invitation 4 of the canoes approached us, containing 30 Indians, or thereabouts. We showed them necklaces of blue glass beads, small mirrors, and green imitation corals. At the sight of the latter they appeared quite delighted, for they thought them to be Trachuwi's stones, which are highly esteemed in their country. Our captain then told them, by means of our interpreters, that we came from a distant country, and were the subjects of a great emperor, whose name was Don Carlos, who had numerous sovereigns and caciques among his vassals. They should likewise acknowledge this emperor as their lord and master, for then it would go well with them. He further desired them to give us fowls in exchange for our glass beads. Two of the Indians, one of whom was the chief and the other a papa, this is a kind of priest, who performs the ceremonies in presence of their idols, answered and said, they would bring the provisions we required and commence a trade of barter with us. For the rest they had already a master, and could not help feeling astonished that we, who had but just arrived and knew nothing of them, should that instant wish to impose a master on them. We had better consider a bit before we commenced war with them, as we had with those at Patoncan. That already all the warriors of the country had been ordered out against us, and two armies, each composed of 8,000 men were ready for action. They certainly had learnt that a few days ago we had killed and wounded 200 men, but they were more powerful than the inhabitants of that country, which was the reason why they first wished to know what our intentions were. Our declaration would be communicated to the caciques of the numerous districts, who had united themselves for war or for peace. Upon this they embraced our commander, in token of peace, who presented them with necklaces of glass beads, and desired them to return as quickly as possible with an answer, adding that if they did not return we would enter their town by main force, though we had no evil intentions whatever. These delegates communicated with the caciques and papas, the latter having also a voice in their councils, and they declared that our offer of peace was acceptable to them. Provisions were ordered to be sent us, and all present agreed that they themselves with the neighboring tribes should each contribute their quota in order to make us a present in gold to ensure our good friendship, and obviate a recurrence of what had taken place at Patoncan. From what I subsequently learnt and witnessed I found that it was customary with the inhabitants of these countries to make each other presents whenever they were in treaty about peace. All I have been relating took place on the promontory where the palm trees stood. About 30 Indians soon arrived, laden with broiled fish, fowls, fruit, and maize bread. They also brought pans filled with red-hot embers, on which they strewed incense, and perfumed us all. After this ceremony was ended they spread some mats on the ground, over which they laid a piece of cotton cloth. On this they put some trifling ornaments in gold in the shape of ducks and lizards, with three necklaces made of gold, which had been melted into the shape of round balls. All these things, however, were of an inferior kind of gold, not worth 200 pesos. They next presented us with some mantles and waistcoats, as they themselves wore, and begged of us to accept them in good kind, saying they had no more gold to give us, but that further on towards the setting of the sun there was a country where it was found in great abundance, hereby often repeating the word Colba, Colba, and Mexico, Mexico. We however did not understand what they meant. Although the presents they had brought us were of little value, we nevertheless rejoiced exceedingly on account of the certainty we had gained that there was gold in this country. Having handed over the presents to us with due formality, they told us we might now continue our voyage. Our captain thanked them, presenting each at the same time with some green beads. We now determined to re-embark, for the vessels were in great danger on account of the north wind, which in our present situation was quite contrary. We had, moreover, to go in quest of the country, which, according to the assurances of the Indians, abounded in gold. Chapter 12. _ We come in sight of the town of Aguadaluco, and give it the name of La Rambla. _ Having again re-embarked, we continued our course along the coast, and perceived on the second day a town close to the seashore, called Aguadaluco. We could discern numbers of Indians hurrying to and fro with huge shields made out of large tortoise shells, which glittered so beautifully in the sun, that some of our men believed they were made of an inferior species of gold. The inhabitants appeared to be walking up and down the shore in great consternation, which induced us to call the village La Rambla, under which name it stands on the sea charts. As we proceeded further along the coast we came to a bay, into which the river Tonalá empties itself. It was this same river we entered on our subsequent voyage. We gave it the name of San Antonio, which it still retains on the maps. We next passed the mouth of the great river Guacajualco, and would gladly have run into the bay which it forms if contrary winds had not prevented us. We now came in sight of the great snow mountain Sierras Nevadas. These are covered the whole year round with snow. There were also other mountains, nearer the coast, to which we gave the name of Holy Martin _, because a soldier of the name of San Martino, a native of the Havana, first descried them. One of the commanders, Pedro de Alvarado, whose vessel was the fastest sailer of the whole, being a great way ahead of the others, ran his ship up a river called by the natives Papalo Huna. This we termed the Alvarado, after the name of the discoverer. Some Indian fishermen of the village Tlacotalpa gave him fish. We could perceive this, though at a great distance from him. Alvarado was followed by two more of our ships. We were therefore obliged to wait until they returned. This digression without the general's leave occasioned ill blood, and Grijalva forbade Alvarado in future to sail in advance of the squadron, fearing he might meet with some accident or other before the rest could possibly come up to his assistance. From this time the four vessels kept close together. We soon after arrived at the mouth of another river, which we termed the Banderas Stream, Flag Stream, from the circumstance that the banks of the river were crowded with Indians bearing small flags of white cloth attached to their lances. They called out and invited us to come on shore, but I will relate in the next chapter what further took place here. Chapter 13. _ How we arrive on the Banderas Stream, and gain 1,500 pesos. _ By this time the existence of the great city of Mexico must be known throughout the major part of the Spanish provinces and the greater part of Christendom, how, like Venice, it was built in the water, and of the mighty monarch who resided there, king of many provinces and lord of all these countries, which in extent were more than quadruple that of Spain. The name of this monarch was Moctezuma. His power was so great that he would gladly have extended it to places where it was impossible, and he wished to know things which he never could learn. He had, however, heard of our first visit under the command of Cordoba, and of our battle at Catoche-en-Champoton, also of the second engagement we had had at the last mentioned spot. He was moreover aware that we had been but a handful of men in comparison with the multitude of the inhabitants, and lastly, it had been made known to him that we gladly exchanged our goods for gold. All this information had, from time to time, been sent him by means of painted figures or signs, drawn, as is the custom with his people, on a thick kind of cloth manufactured from the maguey, 6, very much resembling our linen. Being also informed that we were continuing our course along the coast, he issued orders to the governors of the several districts that at every place where we landed they should exchange their gold for our glass beads, but particularly for the green ones, which so much resembled their Chachuis stones, and further he commanded them to gain every information with respect to our intentions. What made him dwell more particularly upon the latter was the ancient tradition in the country, which spoke of a people that would come from the rising of the sun who would at some future period get the dominion of the country. For whatever purpose it may have been, I will leave, but certain it is that the powerful Moctezuma had ordered sentinels to be posted along the banks of the river above mentioned. These sentinels had all small flags attached to the points of their lances, and called out aloud, inviting us to come to them. While we were contemplating from our vessels this, to us, so novel a sight, our commander-in-chief with the other officers and soldiers came to the determination to inquire their meaning. We therefore lowered two of our boats and manned them with 20 soldiers, well armed with crossbows and muskets. The command of this was given to Francisco de Montejo. I was likewise among the number. Our instructions were to send immediate information to the commander-in-chief if anything of a hostile nature should take place, and in general to let him know how matters stood. It pleased God that the weather should be calm, which is seldom the case on these coasts. We all got safe on shore, and were met by three caciques, one of whom was a governor under Moctezuma. These were attended by great numbers of Indians, carrying fowls, maize bread, pines, sapotas, and other provisions. They spread some mats in the shade of the trees, on which they invited us to sit down. All this was done by signs, as Julianello did not understand their language. Next they brought pans made of clay, filled with glowing embers, on which they strewed a species of resin, smelling very much like our incense, with which they perfumed us. Francisco de Montejo sent information of all this to our commander-in-chief, who immediately resolved to run the whole squadron into the bay, and proceed on shore with all our men. When the caciques and the governor saw our general on shore, who, they had been given to understand, was our chief officer, they paid him in their way the greatest possible respect, and perfumed him most vehemently. We thanked them kindly, and in return made many protestations of friendship, also presenting each with white and green glass beads, desiring them at the same time to bring us gold in exchange for our commodities. Moctezuma's governor strongly advised the Indians to comply with our request, the consequence of which was that the inhabitants of the surrounding district soon brought us every trinket they possessed in the shape of gold, and commenced a trade of barter with us. During the 6 days we stayed in this spot we obtained upwards of 1,500 pesos worth of gold trinkets, of various workmanship, but of inferior quality. The historians Francisco López de Gomara and Gonzalo Hernández de Oviedo have also mentioned this circumstance in their works. They err, however, when they say it took place in the Tabasco or Grijalva River, for it is a well-authenticated fact that there is no gold found in the provinces which border on the river Grijalva, and, upon the whole, very few ornaments of gold. I will not, however, detain my reader with their account, but rather inform him that we took possession of this country for His Imperial Majesty the Emperor, in the name of Diego Velázquez, the governor of Cuba. This being done, our general told the Indians that he was now desirous of re-embarking, and presented them with some Spanish shirts. We took one of the Indians with us, who subsequently learned our language and was converted to Christianity, when he took the name of Francisco. I met with him afterwards at Santa Fe, where he had settled himself after the conquest of Mexico. Our commander, finding that the inhabitants brought no more gold, and considering that we had already been here 6 days, and that our present anchorage was rather dangerous on account of the contrary winds, gave orders for re-embarking. Pursuing our voyage, we came to an island which was quite covered with white sand, lying above 9 miles from the mainland. We gave it the name of Isla Blanca, as it stands on the sea charts. Not far from this lay another island, nearly 5 miles from the mainland, which offered us a very commodious landing place. Our general, therefore, ordered the boats to be lowered, and landed, with the greater portion of our men, in order to explore the island. We found 2 houses, which were strongly built of stone and lime, both were ascended by a flight of steps, and surmounted by a species of altar, on which stood several abominable idols, to whom, the previous evening, 5 Indians had been sacrificed. Their dead bodies still lay there, ripped open, with the arms and legs chopped off, while everything near was besmeared with blood. We contemplated this sight in utter astonishment, and gave this island the name of Isla de Sacrificios. Quitting this place, we landed on the neighboring continent, where we constructed ourselves huts on one of the large downs, with some sails and the branches of trees. Numbers of Indians soon made their appearance, bringing with them small pieces of gold for barter, in the same way as at the Bandera stream, according to the commands of Moctezuma, as we subsequently learned. The inhabitants, however, approached us in great fear, and what they brought with them was a mere trifle. Our captain, therefore, soon weighed anchor again. The next place we landed at was in view of another island, which lay about 2 miles from the continent. This at present is considered the best harbor of the country. What happened to us in this place I will relate in the next chapter. 4 Chapter 14 Underscore how we came into the harbor of San Juan de Culua. Underscore. Having disembarked on a part of the coast where it was very sandy, we were annoyed by such multitudes of mushtos that we were forced to construct ourselves huts on the great downs and in the tops of trees. This being done, we carefully examined the harbor in our boats, and were fully satisfied that it contained a good anchorage, it being moreover sheltered against the north wind by the island, to which our general now proceeded with 30 men all well armed. Here we found a temple on which stood the great and abominable looking god Tezcatlipuca, surrounded by 4 Indians, dressed in wide black cloaks, and with flying hair, in the same way as our canons or Dominicans wear it. These were priests, who had that very day sacrificed 2 boys, whose bodies they had ripped up, and then offered their bleeding hearts to the horrible idol. They were going to perfume us in the same way they had done their gods, and though it smelled like our incense, we would not suffer them, so shocked were we at the sight of the 2 boys whom they had recently murdered, and disgusted with their abominations. Our captain questioned the Indian Francisco whom we had brought with us from the Bandera stream as to what was meant by all this, for he seemed rather an intelligent person, having, at that time, as I have already stated, no interpreter. Our captain put these questions to him by means of signs. Francisco returned for answer that this sacrifice had been ordered by the people of Culua, but, as it was difficult for him to pronounce this latter word, he kept continually saying underscore. From the circumstance of our commander himself being present, and that his Christian name was Juan, and it happening to be the feast of St. John, we gave this small island the name of San Juan de Ulua. This harbor was ever after much frequented. Great numbers of ships have been refitted there, and all merchandise from Mexico and New Spain are here shipped or unladen. During the time we were encamped on these downs, numbers of Indians from the surrounding districts brought us their gold trinkets in exchange for our goods, but there was so little of it, and that so very inferior in quality, that we scarcely troubled ourselves about it. We remained, nevertheless, 7 days in the huts we had constructed, though we were constantly annoyed by swarms of mushtos, which rendered our stay most uncomfortable. As we had now been so long at sea, and had fully convinced ourselves that it was no island, but a continent, we had discovered, containing considerable towns, as our cassava bread was become quite moldy and unfit for eating, considering, moreover, that our numbers were too small to think of making any settlement here, particularly as we had lost 10 of our men in consequence of their wounds, besides having 4 others dangerously ill. We determined to forward Diego Velasquez an account of the state of affairs, and desire him to send us succors. Indeed Grijalva had a great mind to have founded a colony even with a few men we had to spare. Our captain had throughout shown a magnanimous spirit, and proved himself a brave soldier, let the historian Gomara say anything to the contrary he likes. Pedro de Alvarado was selected to go on this mission to Cuba, with the ship San Sebastian, which had become rather leaky. This vessel could be refitted there, and return with succors and provisions. He also took with him all the gold we had bartered for, the cotton stuffs presented us by the Indians, and our sick. Our principal officers, moreover, each sent Diego Velasquez a written account, according to their several views, of all we had seen. We will now leave Pedro de Alvarado to his own good fortune on his voyage to Cuba, and relate what happened to the vessel which Diego Velasquez sent in quest of us. 5 Chapter 15 Underscore Diego Velasquez sends out a small vessel in quest of us. Underscore. From the very moment in which Juan de Grijalva had quitted Cuba for the wide ocean, Diego Velasquez became downcast and thoughtful. He was constantly harassed by the idea that some misfortune would befall us. In the height of his impatience he at last sent out a small vessel, with 7 men, in quest of us. The command of this was given to a certain Cristobal de Oli, a man of great courage and energy. His instructions were to follow the same course in which Cordoba had sailed, until he should have met with us. It appears, however, that Cristobal de Oli, while riding at anchor near the coast, was overtaken by a violent storm, and found himself compelled, in order to save his vessel from being cast ashore, to cut the cables. At least he had no anchor left on his return to Santiago de Cuba, nor had he been able to bring the governor any information respecting us. Diego Velasquez now despaired more than ever. The arrival of Pedro de Alvarado with the gold and other things, fortunately set his anxiety at rest, who, moreover, detailed to him the discoveries we had made. His joy was excessive when he saw the gold, and how it was worked into various shapes, from which very circumstance it appeared to him and others who happened to be present on business, of much greater value than it really was, nor were His Majesty's officials, who had to take the 5th part, less astonished at the riches of the countries we had discovered. Pedro de Alvarado, who knew how to humor Diego Velázquez, afterwards related that the governor had continually embraced him, that festivities and tournaments were celebrated for 8 successive days. If the fame of the riches of these countries had been rumored abroad before, it was now, on account of the gold we had sent, the more so, it soon spread through all the islands, and the whole of Spain. I shall have occasion to speak of this hereafter, and will also leave Diego Velázquez to his festivities, and return to our vessels at San Juan de Ulúa. 6 Chapter 16 Underscore what befell us on our coasting voyage along the Tusta and Tuspa Mountains. Underscore. After Pedro de Alvarado had set sail for Cuba, our general and other officers held a consultation with the pilots, when it was determined that we should continue our course along the coast, and push our discoveries as far as possible. As we sailed along, we first came in view of the Tusta, and, 2 days after, of the more elevated mountains of Tuspa, both of which take their names from two towns lying close to the foot of these mountains. On the whole, we saw numbers of towns lying from 6 to 9 miles inland, now the province of Panuco. At last we arrived at a large stream, to which we gave the name of Canoe River, and dropped anchor at its mouth. While our vessels were lying at anchor here, and our men had become less careful than usual, 16 large canoes full of Indians, all equipped for battle, with bows, arrows, and lances, came down the stream and made straight for our smallest vessel, commanded by Alonso de Vila, which lay nearest the shore. They greeted our men with a shower of arrows, wounding 2 of the soldiers, and then lay hold of the vessel as if they meant to carry her off, after they had cut one of the cables. We now hastened to the assistance of Alonso, who was still bravely repelling his assailants, and had capsized 3 of their canoes. We were well armed with crossbows and muskets, and very soon wounded at least above 1/3 of our enemies, who speedily retreated to where they had come from, not exactly in the best of spirits. Upon this we weighed anchor and continued our course along the coast until we arrived at a wide projecting cape, which, on account of the strong currents, we found so difficult to double that we considered our further course now impeded. The chief pilot, Alaminos, here told our commander that it was no longer advisable to sail on an adventure, for which he gave us many plausible reasons. This matter being duly considered in council, it was unanimously agreed that we should return to Cuba. To this step we were, moreover, induced by the approach of winter, scarcity of provisions, and the bad condition of one of our vessels which had become very leaky. To this may also be added the disagreement between our commanders, for Juan de Grijalva persisted in his opinion that they should make an attempt to leave a colony behind, while Francisco de Montejo and Alonso de Vila, on the contrary, maintained that any such attempt would be fruitless, considering the multitude of warriors which inhabited these countries. To all this may be added that our men were heartily sick of the sea. We therefore turned our vessels about, hoisted all the sails, and arrived in a few days, being greatly assisted by the currents, in the wide waters of the Guacajualco River. We could not make any stay here on account of the boisterous state of the weather, and therefore continued our course along the coast until we arrived at the mouth of the river Tonalá, to which we gave the name of Saint Antonio. We ran up this river and careened the leaky vessel, which had struck there several times against the rocks. While we were busily engaged at this work, numbers of Indians came up to us from the harbor of Tonalá, which lay about 4 miles from this place, bringing with them maize bread, fish, and fruits, which they readily gave us. Our commander was particularly kind to them, and presented each with white and green glass beads, giving them at the same time to understand by signs that they should bring us gold in exchange for our goods. They soon complied with our wishes, but their gold was of a very inferior quality, for which they received imitation corals. As soon as the inhabitants of Guacajualco and the neighboring districts had learned that we offered our goods for barter, they brought us all their golden ornaments, and took in exchange green glass beads, on which they set a high value. Besides ornaments of gold, every Indian had with him a copper axe, which was very highly polished, with the handle curiously carved, as if to serve equally for an ornament as for the field of battle. At first we thought that these axes were made of an inferior kind of gold, we therefore commenced taking them in exchange, and, in the space of 2 days, had collected more than 600, with which we were no less rejoiced as long as we were ignorant of their real value, than the Indians with our glass beads. One of our sailors, who had by stealth bought 7 of these axes and was secretly congratulating himself on this piece of good fortune, was betrayed to our commander-in-chief, who, ordering the man in his presence, commanded him to deliver up his treasure. Still of opinion that these axes were of gold, the poor fellow, though forced, reluctantly parted with them. This brings to my mind what befell one of our men, named Bartolome Prado. This fellow had managed to get inside of a temple, called by the Indians a Q7, which stood upon an elevated spot, and had found in it numerous idols, and some copal, which is the incense of the Indians, also knives made of hard flint, with which they cut their meat offerings, and otherwise make use of in their sacrifices. Besides these things, he found two small wooden boxes, filled with golden trinkets which are worn about the head and neck, also small idols, and other ornaments somewhat resembling our pearls. The idols he brought to his commander, but took care to keep the gold himself. It seems, however, that someone had been watching him all the time, who reported what he had seen to our captain. We all felt concerned at this, and spoke a good word for him, as he was a kind-hearted being. We begged hard of our commander that he might be allowed to retain his treasure, minus the fifth part claimed for the emperor, which being granted, the man had nigh upon 80 pesos left for himself. In this place I must also acquaint my readers how I sowed some orange seeds close to one of these temples. On account of the numbers of mushtos which swarm along this river, I had, being tired, laid myself down to rest on the summit of a high temple, in gratitude for the quiet slumber I enjoyed there. I sowed, at the foot of this building, 8 orange seeds which I had brought with me from Cuba. These seeds grew very fast, and when grown to small plants, were most probably watered and preserved from the ants by the pappas, as soon as they perceived the new plant. I have merely related this in order to acquaint my reader that these were the first orange seeds that were planted in New Spain. Subsequent to the conquest of Mexico and friendly subjection of the Indian tribes on the Guacajualco, this province, being excellently situated, was considered of greater importance than any other, no less on account of its mines than for its beautiful harbor. The country, moreover, abounded in gold, and contained fine pastures for sheep, which was the reason why the most illustrious of the conquistadors 8 of Mexico settled themselves there, among which number was myself, and I did not forget to look for my orange trees, which, indeed, I transplanted, and they afterwards flourished uncommonly. I am well aware that it will be said, such old tales as these are quite out of character here. I will not, therefore, say another syllable on the subject, but merely acquaint the reader that the inhabitants of these districts were all very much pleased with us, and embraced us at our departure. We set sail for Cuba, and arrived there in the space of 40 days, during which time the weather was sometimes favorable and sometimes boisterous. We were most friendly received by the governor Diego Velasquez, who was highly delighted with the additional gold we brought him. Altogether it was well worth 4,000 pesos, so that with the 16,000 brought over by Alvarado, the whole amounted to 20,000 pesos. Some make this sum greater, some less, but one thing is certain, the crown officials only took the fifths of the last mentioned sum. When they were about to take this also of the Indian axes, which we had mistaken for gold, they grew excessively angry on finding them to be merely of a fine species of copper, nor did this circumstance fail to produce the usual laughter at the expense of our trade of barter. Diego Velasquez, however, appeared perfectly satisfied, though not so with his relative Grijalva. This was wrong on his part, for it originated solely in the misrepresentations of Alonso de Vila, a man of a bad disposition, who did all he could, backed by Montejo, to lower Grijalva in his eyes. All this rumor spread was done in order to fit out another armament, and select a new commander. 7 Chapter 17 _ Diego Velasquez dispatches one of his officials to Spain. _ My readers may perhaps think, that what I am now about to relate does not exactly belong to this history, but in the course of it they will readily perceive that I have been obliged to notice many circumstances before I could introduce them to the captain, Hernando Cortes. They ought also to bear in mind, that it often happens that two or three things take place at the same moment, in which case there only remains for the historian to treat of one circumstance after the other, and begin with that which lies nearest at hand. In this place the following comes first under our consideration. After the arrival of Pedro de Alvarado with the gold which we had made in the newly discovered country, Diego Velasquez began to fear that some, one at court, who might have received private information of all this, would anticipate him, in forwarding His Imperial Majesty the first news of our important discovery, and so rob him of the reward. He, therefore, dispatched one of his chaplains, named Benito Martinez, a thorough man of business, to Spain, with letters and a few of the valuable things, to Don Juan Rodriguez Fonseca, Bishop of Burgos, and Archbishop of Rosano. He wrote at the same time to the licentiate Luis Zapata, and the secretary Lope Conchillos, who at that time had the conduct of all Indian affairs under the archbishop. Diego Velasquez was quite devoted to these gentlemen, and had presented them with considerable Indian villages in Cuba, with the inhabitants of which they worked their gold mines. But he took particular care to provide well for the archbishop, troubling himself very little about His Majesty, who was at that time in Flanders. He sent moreover to these, His patrons, a great portion of the gold trinkets which Alvarado had brought with him, for everything that was determined in the Imperial Council of India depended upon these gentlemen. Diego Velázquez therefore sought, by means of his chaplain, to obtain unlimited permission to fit out armaments at any time he might think proper to make voyages of discovery, and to found colonies in the new countries as well as in those that might subsequently be discovered. In the accounts he transmitted to Spain, he spoke of the many thousands of gold pesos which he had already spent in like undertakings, thereby giving such a favorable direction to the negotiations of his chaplain, Benito Martinez, that his expectations were more than fulfilled, who even obtained for him the additional title of Adelantado of Cuba. This latter appointment, however, did not arrive until the new expedition under Cortés had left. I will not make any further remarks on these matters at present, but rather say a few words respecting Francisco López de Gomar's history of the conquest of New Spain and Mexico. His history fell into my hands while I was writing my own, and I soon foresaw that I should have to contradict him in many instances. My intention is to give a faithful account, and that in due order, of every circumstance. This will greatly differ from his narrative, which is quite at variance with truth. Chapter 18. Underscore of some errors in the work of Francisco López de Gomara. Underscore. While busily engaged writing this narrative, the eloquent history of the conquest of Mexico and New Spain, by Gomara, fell into my hands, and when I perceived the elegance of his style, and considered the rudeness of my own, I laid down my pen, ashamed at the very thoughts of its being read by men of distinction. With my spirits thus damped, I once more undertook to go through his history. It was then I, for the first time, discovered how mistaken this author was with respect to the occurrences which had really taken place in New Spain. He is equally bad whenever he writes about the magnitude of the towns and number of the inhabitants, in which, whenever it suits him, he does not, for instance, hesitate a moment to put 8,000 for 8. In the same way he mentions the extensive buildings we were stated to have commenced, though, in fact, we were only 400 in number when we first went out to war, and had sufficient work to defend ourselves and prevent the victory from going over to our enemies. Though the Indians may have been timid, we were, nevertheless, guiltless of such wholesale slaughter and other barbarities as Gomara would lay to our doors. On the contrary, such was our situation, and I hereby seal my words with an oath when I state, that we daily offered up our prayers to God and the Holy Virgin to preserve us from destruction. Alaric was certainly a most courageous monarch, and Attila a soldier whose excessive pride would not allow him to shrink back from anything, yet they never slaughtered such multitudes of human beings on the Catalonian plains as we do in the Book of Gomara. In the same way he mentions what numbers of towns and temples we either burnt or destroyed. I am speaking of the Indian temples, called by the inhabitants Cues. This latter circumstance would certainly be most pleasing to his readers, but he never gave it a thought, when he was writing, that the conquistadors themselves, and those better informed, would detect his errors and falsehoods. Even in his other works, whenever he speaks about New Spain, he immediately commits blunders. In one place he praises a commander far above his merits, for which very reason he in another most unjustly diminishes that of a second. In another place again, he gives many a one a command who was not even in the army during the conquest. He gives, for instance, the chief command at the battle fought near the town afterwards called Almería, to Pedro de Rico, when, in fact, it was Juan Escalante who commanded on that occasion, and was killed with seven of his men. Again he says, that Juan Velázquez de León founded the colony of Guacajualco, although it was Gonzalo de Sandoval, of Avila. There is as much truth in his account when he says that Cortés ordered the Indian Quetzalpapaca, one of Moctezuma's chiefs, to be burnt, together with the village in which it was stated he had hid himself. Equal reliance may be placed in his description of our entry into the town and fortress of Ungapanga, where everything happened exactly contrary to what he has stated. In his narrative of our proceedings on the downs, when we had appointed Cortés Captain General and Chief Justice, he has allowed himself to be deceived by false information, while he has totally misrepresented our taking of the town Chamula, in the province of Quiapa. A still greater blunder he commits when he states that Cortés issued his orders secretly for the destruction of the 11 vessels which had brought us to New Spain, for it is perfectly well known that the ships were run on shore by our unanimous consent, and in presence of us all, in order that the sailors might also be armed and accompany us on our march. In like manner he lowers the merits of Juan de Grijalva, although he had proved himself such a worthy officer, while he passes by Hernández de Córdoba in silence, though he was the first who discovered Yucatán. Of Francisco de Garay he says, that he had accompanied us on the previous expedition under Grijalva, though he first visited New Spain during this last expedition. In the account he gives of the arrival of Narváez, and the victory we gained over him, he is certainly more faithful, and has been well informed of all the circumstances, but, with respect to the battles with the Tlaxcalans, up to the time when peace was concluded with them, he has again diverged from the truth. Concerning the battle we fought in the city of Mexico itself, in which we were worsted and beaten back with the loss of 860 of our troops, of whom a great portion was sacrificed to the idols, I repeat, where above 860 of our men were killed, for out of 1,300 soldiers who had marched into the town to the relief of Pedro de Alvarado, which made out the united forces of Narvaez and Cortes, only 440 escaped, and even these were all wounded. Of this great and important deed of arms he speaks as if it were a mere nothing. He says as little of the subsequent conquest we made of the great city of Mexico, or the manner in which we accomplished it, and omits to mention the number of our killed and wounded, as if this undertaking had merely been a jolly marriage procession. But why should I continue to enumerate all these particularities one by one? It is a mere waste of ink and paper. I can only say that it is a great pity if Gomara pursues the same course in all his works, for in the beautiful style in which he writes, he ought to make truth perceptible, and distinguish himself therein. But enough of Gomara. I have sufficiently proved, to the sorrow of his readers, how far he has gone beside the truth. I will now return to my history, and strive to act up to the advice of wise men, who say that honesty and truth are the true ornaments to history. Indeed, my rude style of writing would be insupportable without truth, and therefore I was determined to put my trust in it, and continue my narrative in the way I had begun, that it might go to the press, and publish to the world the conquest of New Spain, as it really took place. In this way His Imperial Majesty will also learn the great services which we, the true conquistadors, have rendered to the crown, how small our numbers were when we first arrived in this country, under the command of our highly favored and faithful captain, Hernando Cortes, what dangers we had to brave, and, lastly, how we conquered this kingdom, which forms a great part of the New World, and for which reason His Majesty, our most Christian King and Master, has so often ordered that we should be rewarded. However, I will not say anything further on this head, though much might be said. In resuming my pen I will, like a careful pilot who throws out the lead when he is in danger of shallows, search after truth, where the historian Gomara flies away from it. I will not, however, detain my readers by entering into minute particulars, but always keep the whole in view, in order that the costs of gathering the leasings may not amount to more than the value of the full vintage. If other historians should further swell out my narrative, and bestow on Cortes, our commander, and on the brave conquistadors in this great and holy expedition, their just measure of praise, I can at least say that I have witnessed for the truth. These, indeed, are not stories about strange countries, or dreams, or contradictory statements. Everything I relate, if I may so say, happened but yesterday, and the whole of New Spain can test these representations, and judge how far those are correct who have written on the same subject. I will relate that of which I myself was an eyewitness, facts which I know to be true, and will pay no attention to the contradictory statements of those who merely write from hearsay, for truth is a sacred thing. I will therefore say no more on this head, though I could, if I liked, say a good deal, and merely add, that there are good grounds for believing that when Gomara was writing his history, he had been deceived by false information. With him, every circumstance is made to turn to the glory and honor of Cortes, while no mention is made of the other brave officers and soldiers. But, the partiality of this author is sufficiently seen from the circumstance of his having dedicated his work to the present Marquis del Valle, son of Cortes, and not to His Majesty the King. But, alas! These untruths and errors are not peculiar to Francisco López de Gomara, but have also been the means of leading many other writers and historians who had followed his work into like error, as for instance, Dr. Illescas and Paolo Jovio, who have exactly copied Gomara's account, without adding or taking away a single word. For all their blunders they are indebted to Gomara. 9 Chapter 19 Underscore how another armament was fitted out for a voyage to the newly discovered countries, the command of which was given to Hernando Cortes, afterwards Marquis of the Vale of Oaxaca, also of the secret cabals which were formed to deprive him of it. Underscore. Immediately after the return of Juan de Grijalva from our last voyage of discovery, in the year 1518, Diego Velázquez issued orders for the fitting out of a more considerable armament than the foregoing. For this purpose he had 10 vessels lying in the harbor of Santiago de Cuba, at his disposal. Among these were the 4 vessels in which we had just returned with Grijalva, which had been immediately refitted and careened. The 6 others had been collected from the different ports of the island. The vessels were provided with sufficient provisions, consisting in cassava bread, tobacco, and smoked bacon, to last us on our voyage to the Havana, where they were to be fully equipped, for at that time there was neither beef nor mutton to be had in Cuba. In the meantime, however, Diego Velázquez could not make up his mind to whom he should entrust the command. Some cavaliers certainly mentioned Vasco Porcolo, a captain of great renown, and related to the Earl of Feria, who, it was said, would shortly arrive to take the command. This man, however, did not suit Diego Velázquez. He feared his daring spirit, and was apprehensive that once having the armament under his command he would declare himself independent of him. Others again spoke of Agustín Bermúdez, Antonio Velázquez Borrego, and Bernardino Velázquez, who were all three relatives of Velázquez. We soldiers, however, would not hear of any other than Juan de Grijalva, who, besides being a brave officer, bore an unblemished character, a man moreover who fully understood the art of commanding. While such like rumors were afloat, the affair was secretly settled, by two confidants of Diego Velázquez, Andreas de Duero, secretary to the governor, and Almador de Larrys, the royal treasurer, with Hernando Cortés. Cortés was a cavalier of rank, a native of Medellín, and son of Martin Cortés de Monroy, and of Catalina Pizarro Altamirano, both descendants of two ancient noble families of Extremadura, though then in rather straitened circumstances. Cortés had an Indian commandery in Cuba, and had been recently married to Doña Catalina Suárez Pacheco, daughter of the late Diego Suárez Pacheco of Avila, and of María de Mercado of Biscay, and sister to Juan Suárez Pacheco, who, subsequent to the conquest of New Spain, took up his abode in Mexico, where he had a commandery. This marriage proved very expensive to Cortés, and had even occasioned his imprisonment. Diego Velázquez favored the family of Cortés's wife, who had been averse to the match, but I must leave this for others to expatiate upon, and rather confine myself to the principal subject in this place, which is, to acquaint my reader that the above-mentioned confidants of Diego Velázquez did all in their power to obtain the appointment of commander-in-chief for Cortés, who, on the other hand, had promised to share equally with them all the profits arising from the gold, silver, and jewels, which pending this expedition should fall to his share, which might turn out very considerable, since the real design of Diego Velázquez, in fitting out this expedition, was not to make settlements, but that a trade of barter should be carried on with the natives. Duero and the royal treasurer, therefore, employed all their cunning with the governor. They took every opportunity of placing Cortés in the most favorable light, extolling his great courage, in a word, declared him to be the most proper person whom he could entrust with the command. In him he might place implicit confidence, the more so since he himself had been present as a witness at Cortés's marriage, and given the bride away, and was thus spiritually related to him. Their endeavors were indeed crowned with success, by Diego Velázquez conferring the appointment of captain general of the expedition on that gentleman. The secretary Duero did not fail on this occasion, as the saying is, to write out the commission with the best of ink, to word it agreeably to Cortés's wishes, and finish it in all haste. When the appointment became known to the public, some approved of it and others not. On the Sunday following, as Diego Velázquez was on his way to church, accompanied by the principal personages in the town, as was due to him in his capacity of governor, it happened that he did Cortés the honor of placing him on his right side. On the road they were met by a jester, nicknamed the Fool Cervantes. This fellow kept in front of the governor, cutting all manner of ridiculous figures and playing all sorts of pranks. "Well a day, friend Diego, commence this jack-pudding, what manner of a captain general have you appointed?" "He have made Ayn in Extremadura. A captain who wants to try his fortune in no small way. I am afraid he will cut his sticks with your whole squadron, for he is a terrible fellow when he once begins, this you may read in his countenance." As he was chattering on in this strain for some time and growing more severe in his observations, Andreas de Duero, who was walking by the side of Cortés, hit him a good blow on the head, crying out at the same time, "Begone, you drunken fool. I am sure these scandalous pleasantries never emanated in your brain." The buffoon, however, took no notice of this, but commenced anew. "Long live my friend Diego and the bold Captain Cortés. Upon my life, Master Diego, I must really go myself with Cortés to those rich countries, in order that you may not reap into the bargain you have made." Nobody doubted for a moment that it was Velázquez, the governor's relative, who had fed the jester with a few pesos to utter these complaints, all emanating from a bad feeling. Everything this fool had predicted, however, took place to the very letter, and only proves that fools often speak the truth. It is nevertheless certain that the appointment of Hernando Cortés was pleasing in the eyes of God, a blessing to our holy religion, and of the first importance to His Majesty, as will be clearly proved in the sequel. Chapter 20. _ of the designs and plans of Hernando Cortés after he had obtained the appointment of captain. _ After Hernando Cortés had thus been appointed captain, He immediately set about to collect all manner of arms and ammunition, consisting of matchlocks, crossbows, powder, and the like. In the same way, he took care to provide a large stock of goods for barter, and other necessaries requisite for our expedition. He was now also most particular in adorning his outward person. More than ordinarily, he stuck a bunch of feathers in his cap, to which he fastened a golden medal, which gave him a very stately appearance. Notwithstanding all this, he was at that time greatly pinched for money to purchase the things he required, being, in addition, head and ears in debt, for, though his commandery was a lucrative one, and his gold mines very productive, he required it all for his own person and the dress of his young wife. For the rest, his countenance was most winning, his conversation agreeable, while he was beloved by every one. He had been twice alcalde of Santiago de Barroco, where he resided, which is esteemed a great honor in these parts. When, therefore, his friends among the merchants, Jaime Trio and a certain Pedro de Caceres, heard of his appointment, they lent him 4,000 gold pesos and other merchandise, upon the income arising from his commandery. With this money he bought a state robe with golden trains, ensigns bearing the arms of our sovereign the king, on each side of which was the figure of a cross, beneath this a Latin inscription, the meaning of which was, "Brothers, let us in true faith follow the cross, and the victory is ours." He then made known by sound of drum and trumpet, in the name of His Majesty and Diego Velasquez the governor, that all those who felt inclined to accompany him to the conquest and colonization of the newly discovered countries, should have a share in the gold, silver, and jewels they might gain. Also that, when anyone settled himself there, he should be presented with an Indian commandery, the distribution of which His Majesty had confided to Diego Velasquez. Although this proclamation was made previous to the return of the chaplain Benito Martinez, whom Diego had dispatched to Spain to procure for him such authority and other powers, yet it made a deep impression among the inhabitants of the island. Cortes, also, at the same time wrote to all his friends, inviting them to join the expedition. Many there were who sold all they were possessed of, to buy themselves arms and a horse, others purchased stores of cassava bread and salted bacon to provision the ships, and otherwise equip themselves as well as they could. Our numbers had increased to 300 soldiers when we left Santiago de Cuba. We were even joined by some of the principal personages of Diego Velasquez's household. Among the number was Diego de Ordaz, his steward. To this he had certainly been advised by his master, to see that nothing was done opposed to his interests, as he did not altogether trust Cortes. There was also Francisco de Morla, Escobar, Heredia, Juan Ruano, Pedro Escudero, and Martin Ramos de Peres of Biscay, with many other friends and acquaintances of Velasquez. Myself I speak of last. Though I have merely enumerated these warriors as they came to my memory, without wishing, however, to give one any preference above the other, I intend hereafter to give the names of them all in the proper place. While Cortes was thus making every exertion to expedite the equipment of the vessels, the malice and envy of the relatives of Velasquez was not silent, who felt themselves most grievously neglected that the command should have been entrusted to Cortes. Velasquez had only shortly beforehand shown his hatred to Cortes on account of his marriage, and even persecuted him. They were therefore the more spiteful, and in every way strove to lower him in the eyes of the governor, hoping thereby to deprive him of the command. Cortes, who was fully acquainted with this, took care to be always at Velasquez's side. He took every opportunity of showing his attachment to him, and spoke of nothing but of the glory of this undertaking, and of the vast riches it could not fail, in a short time, to bring his patron Velasquez. Even Andreas de Duero urged Cortes by all means to hasten the embarkation, as the relatives of Velasquez had already succeeded in altering his sentiments with regard to Cortes. The latter therefore desired his wife to send him on board the provisions and other presents which women under such circumstances are accustomed to give their husbands. He made known to the masters and pilots of the different vessels the day and hour of departure, and ordered all the men to be on board by a certain day. Everything being now ready for his departure, and all the men on board, Cortes called upon the governor to take leave of him, and was accompanied on this occasion by his best friends and companions in arms, Andreas de Duero, the royal treasurer, Almador de Lares, and the principal inhabitants of the town. Velasquez and Cortes vowed eternal friendship, and did not part until they had several times embraced each other. The next morning early we attended mass, after which we marched to our vessels accompanied by the governor and a number of cavaliers in honorable escort. The weather being very fine, we arrived, after a few days' sail, safely in the harbor of Trinidad, and landed there. From what has already been said, and will further be seen in the following chapter, the reader may easily imagine the various difficulties Cortes had to struggle with, though, when my narrative is confronted with that of Gomara, it will be found how greatly they differ. Gomara, for instance, We'll have that Andreas de Duero was a merchant, though, as private secretary to the governor, he had considerable weight in the island, and of Diego de Ordaz, he says, that he accompanied the expedition under Grijalva, though he never went out until this time with Cortes. But I will leave Gomara and his miserable history, and relate our doings in the town of Trinidad. 1 Chapter 21 _ Cortes's occupations at Trinidad, and of the cavaliers and warriors who there joined our expedition, and other matters. _ On the first notice of our arrival at Trinidad, the inhabitants came out to welcome us and our commander Cortes. Among the great body of cavaliers in this place, everyone strove hardest to have Cortes for his guest. Cortes immediately planted his standard in front of his dwelling, and made the public acquainted with the particulars of the expedition in the same way as he had done at Santiago, and further collected whatever he could in the shape of firearms with other necessaries. Here we were also joined by the Alvarados, namely, Pedro, who has often been mentioned in this history, his brothers Gonzalo, Jorge, Gomez, and his natural brother the elder Juan Alvarado. Further we were here joined by Alonso de Avila of Avila, who had a command in the last expedition, under Grijalva, Juan de Escalante, Pedro Sanchez Farson of Sevilla, Gonzalo Mejia, subsequently treasurer at Mexico, Vina, Juan S. de Fue and Arabia, and Cristobal de Oli, who had a command at the taking of Mexico, and in all the battles fought in New Spain. Further, Ortiz, the musician, and Gaspar Sanchez, nephew to the treasurer of Cuba, Diego de Pinedo, Alonso Rodriguez, who possessed some lucrative gold mines, and Bartolome Garcia. To which may be added many other cavaliers whose names at present I cannot remember, all personages of influence and respectability. From this place Cortes also wrote letters to San Espiritus, 54 miles from Trinidad, and made our expedition known to the public there. He knew so well how to mix up his sentences with inviting expressions and great promises, that many of the first personages of that town were thereby induced to join us. These were Hernando Pure de Carrero, cousin to the Earl of Medellin, and Gonzalo de Sandoval, who had been 8 months alguacil major and governor, and was afterwards a commander in New Spain, also Juan Velasquez de Leon, a relation of Diego Velasquez, Rodrigo Rangel, Gonzalo López de Jimena, with his brother Juan López, and Juan Sedino. This latter gentleman was an inhabitant of San Espiritus, and had joined Cortes because of the two other Sedinos who were among us. These gentlemen, who were all men of consequence, had arrived at the same time in Trinidad, when Cortes, accompanied by the whole of us, went out to meet them. Cannons were fired, and other rejoicings took place on this occasion, while professions of esteem and friendship were passed from one party to the other. All these men possessed land in the neighborhood of this town, where they ordered cassava bread to be made, and bacon to be cured, and otherwise collected all the provisions they possibly could for our vessels. Here also we hired soldiers, and purchased some horses, which latter, at that time, were very scarce, and only to be had at exorbitant prices. Alonso Hernandez de Pure de Carrero, whom I had previously known, had not sufficient money to purchase himself a horse. Cortes, therefore, bought one for him, and paid for it with the golden borders of the velvet robe he had procured at Santiago. About this time there also arrived in the port of Trinidad a vessel belonging to a certain Juan Sedino, of the Havana, laden with cassava bread and salted meat, which was destined for the mines of Santiago. This Sedino, who had called upon our commander to pay his respects, was soon persuaded, by the eloquence and address of Cortes, to sell him his ship with the lading and all, and himself to join the expedition. We had now 11 ships in all, and everything, thanks to Providence, was going on well, when letters arrived from Diego Velasquez with peremptory orders that Cortes was to be deprived of the command. But I will detail this matter in the following chapter. 2 Chapter 22 _ How the governor Diego Velasquez sends two of his officials in all haste to Trinidad, with full power and authority to deprive Cortes of his appointment of captain, and bring the squadron away, and see. I must now carry my narrative back a few days, in order to relate what happened at Santiago de Cuba after our departure. We had scarcely set sail when Diego Velasquez's friends left him not a moment's peace, harassing him until they had totally revolutionized his sentiments with regard to Cortes. They now plainly told him that he might consider Cortes as lost to his interests from his having so secretly sneaked away from the harbor. Neither had he made any secret of his determination to have the chief command of the armament, whether Diego might wish it or not, for which reason he had embarked his men at nighttime, that if any attempt were made to deprive him of a squadron, he would resist it by main force. He, the governor, had been deceived by his private secretary Duero, and Delares the royal treasurer, who had both made some previous agreement with Cortes to procure him the command. But in particular, the relatives of Velazquez were constantly urging him to cancel the recent appointment of Cortes, in which they were backed by a certain old man, named Juan Milan, commonly termed the astrologer, who was considered by many not to be exactly in his proper senses. This old man repeatedly told the governor that Cortes would now revenge himself for his having, some time ago, thrown him into prison. Sly and artful as he is, he will be the means of ruining you, if you are not upon your guard. These hints were not thrown away upon Velazquez. They brought about a revolution in his mind, which ended in his dispatching two trustworthy persons out of his establishment, with private instructions to his brother-in-law Francisco de Verdugo, then alcalde major of Trinidad, by which he was peremptorily commanded, under all circumstances, to deprive Cortes of the squadron, whose appointment of captain had been withdrawn, and given to Vasco Porcolo. At the same time he wrote letters to Diego de Ordaz, Francisco de Morla, and to his relations and friends, desiring them, at all events, to leave the squadron. As soon as Cortes got information of this, he had a secret interview with Ordaz and all those officers and inhabitants of Trinidad, who, he thought, might feel inclined to obey the orders of Velazquez. To these he spoke so feelingly, and in such kind terms, accompanied by such great promises, that they were all soon gained over to his side. Diego de Ordaz even undertook to advise the alcalde major Francisco de Verdugo not to put these commands immediately into execution, and to keep them secret, telling him, at the same time, he had seen nothing in Cortes which gave the slightest reasons for suspecting him of anything wrong. On the contrary, he had, on every occasion, given proofs of his adherence to the governor. He assured him, moreover, that it would be an impossibility to deprive Cortes of the command of the squadron, in which he had so many friends among the cavaliers, and Diego Velazquez so many enemies, who would not easily forgive him that he had neglected to bestow on the more profitable commanderies. Besides the number of friends Cortes had among the officers, he could rely upon most of the soldiers, and thus it would be useless to attempt anything against him. The whole town would become mixed up in the quarrel, which would be plundered by our men, and even worse consequences might follow. By these arguments, Ordaz prevented all violent measures, and one of the above-mentioned officials, whom Diego had sent with dispatches to his nephew, named Pedro Lasso, even joined our expedition. The other, Cortes sent back with a letter to the governor, in which he made use of every kind sentiment, and expressed his utter astonishment at the resolution he had taken, particularly as he had no other design than to serve God, His Majesty the King, and the governor. He earnestly advised him not to listen any further to his cousin Velazquez, nor to allow the kind feeling he entertained for him to be poisoned by such an old fool as Juan Milan. Cortes, at the same time, wrote to his other friends, and in particular to his two confederates, the private secretary and royal treasurer. The next step he took was to command his men to put their arms into good repair. Every smith in the town was set to work to fix points to our lances, and the gunners were ordered to search every magazine for arrows. He at last even persuaded the very smiths to join the armament. We remained altogether 12 days at Trinidad, and thence sailed for the Havana. From the foregoing statement, the reader will readily perceive how differently all this has been related by Gomara, who even makes Velazquez confer the chief command on Ordaz. The latter, he says, invited Cortes to dine with him on board his vessel, had him seized while at dinner, and taken off prisoner to Santiago. I could cite many similar errors from Gomara's history, and thereby convince the reader that it is better to believe an eyewitness than an author who writes about things he never saw. However, enough of Gomara, let us return to our subject. 3 Chapter 23 _ Cortes embarks with all his cavaliers and soldiers in order to sail along the south side of the island to the Havana, and sends off one of the vessels to go around the north coast for the same port. _ Cortes, finding that he had nothing further to do at Trinidad, acquainted his officers and men with the hour of departure, leaving it to each one's choice either to proceed to the Havana by sea, or march thither overland, under the command of Pedro de Alvarado, who would be joined by some men from one of the colonies, on his road. Alvarado was a kind-hearted man, who knew best how to deal with soldiers, wherefore I myself, with 50 other military men, gladly joined him. Our numbers were, moreover, increased by all our horse. Cortes also sent a vessel, under the command of Juan de Escalante, which was to shape its course around the north coast of the Havana. Cortes then embarked, and proceeded, with the whole squadron, for the same port. The transport ships must, however, have missed the vessel of our commander-in-chief in the night, as they all arrived safe at the Havana without it. The troops under Pedro de Alvarado also arrived in good time, and the vessel under the command of Escalante, which had sailed around the north coast. Cortes alone remained behind, nor could anyone account for his delay, Or what could possibly have detained him? 5 days passed away without our obtaining the least tidings of him, and we already began to fear that he had been shipwrecked off the Jardines, 9, which lie from 30 to 36 miles from the Havana, near the Pinos Isles, where the sea is very shallow. We therefore determined to send out our 3 smaller vessels in quest of her. But what with the fitting out of these vessels, added to the manifold opinions and advices, 2 more days elapsed, and Cortes still remained behind. All manner of artifices were now had recourse to, as to whom the command should be given, until some certainty was gained respecting the fate of Cortes, in which Diego de Ordaz, in his capacity of steward over the household of Velasquez, and secret observer of our movements, was most active. The following misfortune had befallen Cortes. When his vessel, which was of considerable tonnage, had arrived off the Pinos Isles on the shallows of the Jardines, there was not sufficient depth of water to carry her, and she consequently got aground. The ship had now to be unladen, which was an easy matter, on account of the nearness of the shore. As soon as she was set afloat again and brought into deeper water, she was reloaded and pursued her voyage to the Havana. The joy among the officers and soldiers was very great as soon as she became visible in the horizon, to those excepted who had prized themselves with the command, to whose machinations, however, there was now an end. We accompanied Cortes to the house of Pedro Barba, Velasquez's lieutenant at Trinidad, where quarters had been got ready for his reception. He immediately hoisted his standard in front of his dwelling, and by public proclamation invited the inhabitants to join the expedition. It was here that Francisco de Montejo first joined us, of whom I shall often have to speak in the course of this history. Subsequent to the conquest of Mexico, he became adelantado and governor of Yucatan in the Honduras. Here we were also joined by Diego de Soto of Toro, namely, who afterwards was Cortes's steward in Mexico, further, Angela and Garcia Caro, Sebastian Rodriguez, Pacheco, Gutierrez, Rawaya, this is not he commonly called the wealthy, also by a young fellow of the name of Santa Clara, the 2 brothers, Martinez del Frexinal and Juan de Naharanot the deaf one of the tennis court at Mexico, all of whom were men of rank and quality. There were also other soldiers who joined us, whose names I have forgotten. When Cortes, therefore, beheld all these cavaliers together, his heart leapt with joy, and he sent off another ship for a further supply of provisions to the promontory of Guaniguanico, where Velasquez had landed property. Here was a village where cassava bread was made, and quantities of swine's flesh cured. He gave the command of this vessel to Diego de Ordaz, who, as Velasquez's steward, ordered matters on his master's property as he liked. Cortes wished to keep him out of the way, having learnt that Ordaz had not spoken in very favorable terms of him during the dispute as to whom the command should be given, when he was detained off the Pinos Isles. Ordaz's instructions were to remain in the harbor of Guaniguanico, after he had taken in his lading, until the arrival there of the vessel which was to sail around the north coast, with which he was then to proceed to the island of Cozumel, provided he received no further instructions by Indian canoes. Francisco de Montejo and other cavaliers of the Havana likewise furnished quantities of cassava bread and cured bacon, there being no other kind of provisions to be had. In the meantime Cortes ordered all our heavy guns, consisting in 10 copper cannons and a few falconets, to be brought on shore and given in charge of an artilleryman, named Mesa, a certain Arbenga who traded to the Levant, and Juan Catalan, to prove them, and otherwise put them into good repair, also to furnish for each the right-sized balls and proper quantity of powder. He also gave them an assistant, named Bartolome de Usagre, and furnished them with vinegar and wine to polish the copper pieces. In the same way all our crossbows were inspected, and their strength ascertained by shooting at the target. Cotton being very plentiful here, we constructed ourselves cuirasses with it, which form the most efficient protection against Indian arrows, pikes, and slings. Here it was also that Cortes put his establishment on a much superior footing, and had himself served as a person of the first quality. He took for his butler a certain Guzman, who was subsequently killed by the Indians. He must not, however, be confounded with Cristobal de Guzman, who afterwards became his steward, and was the man whom took the King Cuauhtemoc prisoner, during the battle in the suburbs of Mexico. Rodrigo Rangel he appointed his chamberlain, and Juan de Cáceres his house steward, who after the conquest of Mexico was considered a man of great wealth. Having ordered all these things, he commanded us to hold ourselves in readiness for embarking, and to distribute the horses among the vessels, for which the necessary quantity of maize and hay had been provided. For memory's sake I will here likewise describe the horses and mares which we took with us on our expedition. Cortes had a dark chestnut stallion, which died afterwards at St. Juan de Ulua. Pedro de Alvarado and Hernando López de Vila had jointly an excellent brown mare, which had been broken in for the field of battle as well as for tournaments. After our arrival in New Spain, Alvarado bought Lopez's share, or perhaps took forcible possession of it. Alonso Hernandez Puertocarrero had a gray-colored mare, which Cortes had purchased for him with the golden borders of his state robe. It was capitally trained for the field of battle. Juan Velasquez de León's mare was of the same color, a noble and powerful animal, full of fire and eager for battle. We commonly termed it the short tail. Cristóbal de Oli had a dark brown fine-spirited horse. Francisco de Montejo and Alonso de Vila had between them a sorrel-colored horse, but of little use in battle. Francisco de Morla had likewise a dark chestnut stallion, one full of fire and wonderfully swift. The light-colored horse of Juan de Escalante was not worth much. The gray-colored mare of Diego de Ordaz, which would never fall, was neither very swift. Gonzalo Dominguez had a small dark brown nag, a very swift and noble animal. Also the brown-colored horse of Pedro González de Truxillo was a swift animal. Moron, who was a native of Vaimo, had a small horse which was pretty well trained. Vina, of Trinidad, had a darkish-colored horse, though a bad leaper. The light-colored chestnut Galloway of De Larrys was, on the other hand, a splendid animal and a capital runner. Ortiz, the musician, and a certain Bartolomé Garcia, who had applied himself to the art of mining, had between them a very good dark-colored horse, which they named the Arriero, mule driver, and was one of the best animals of the whole corps. Juan Sedino, of the Havana, had a fine chestnut mare, which foaled on board. This Sedino was considered to be the most wealthy man amongst us, for he had a ship of his own, a horse, a few negroes to attend upon him, and his own lading of cassave and cured bacon. Just about this time horses and negroes were only to be purchased for very high prices, which accounts for the small number of the former we had with us on this expedition. However, I will stop here, and relate in the next chapter what happened as we were just about to embark. For chapter 24. _ Diego Velasquez sends one of his officials, named Gaspar Garnica, with full authority to take Cortes prisoner, whatever might be the consequence, and what further happened. _ In order that my history may be perfectly intelligible to my readers, I must sometimes recur to prior events. In this place I have to return to Diego Velasquez, who, when he learnt that his brother-in-law, Francisco Verdugo, sub-governor of Trinidad, had not only confirmed Cortes in his appointment over the squadron, but even, conjointly with Diego de Ordaz, lent him every possible assistance, fell into such a rage that he roared like a wild beast. He accused his private secretary Andreas de Duero, and the royal treasurer Almador de Larrys, of a conspiracy to cheat him, adding, that Cortes had run off with the whole squadron. Nor did Velasquez stop here, but dispatched one of his officials with imperative commands to Pedro Barba, sub-governor of the Havana, at the same time writing to all his relatives in that town, to De Ordaz and to Juan Velasquez de León, who were his special confidants, requiring them to swear, by the friendship they bore him, not, under any pretense whatsoever, to allow the squadron to depart, but to send Cortes prisoner to Santiago. As soon as Garnica, the bearer of these dispatches, arrived, it was immediately guessed for what purpose he came. Cortes was even apprised of it by means of the very bearer himself, for one of the Brethren of Charity, who was much in company with Velasquez, and greatly in favor with him, had forwarded by this same Garnica a letter to a brother of the same order, named Bartolomé de Olmedo, who had joined our expedition. By means of this letter, Cortes was apprised of the whole posture of affairs by those interested with him, Andreas de Duero and the royal treasurer. Ordaz, as we have above seen, having been sent off in quest of provisions, Cortes had now only to fear opposition from Juan Velasquez de León, but even him he had half gained over to his side, not being on the best of terms with his relative the governor, who had only presented him with a very poor commandery. Thus it was that the design of Velasquez was frustrated by those very persons to whom he had written. Indeed, from that very moment, these personages only united themselves the closer to Cortes, particularly the sub-governor Pedro Barba, the Alvarados, Puertocarrero, Montejo, Cristóbal de Oli, Juan de Escalante, Andreas de Monjerats, and his brother Gregorio, who, with all of us, were ready to stake our lives for Cortes. Had the orders of Velasquez been kept secret in Trinidad, they were now the more so in this place, and Pedro de Barba dispatched Garnica to Diego Velasquez with the information that he durst not venture to take Cortes into custody, as he was too powerful and too much beloved by the soldiers, fearing, if he should make the attempt, that the town would be plundered, and the whole of the inhabitants forcibly dragged away. For the rest, he could assure Diego Velasquez that Cortes was quite devoted to him, and did nothing that could be said to militate against his interests. Cortes himself also wrote a letter couched in those smooth terms he so very well knew how to employ, assuring Velazquez of the unabated friendship he entertained for him, and that he was going to set sail the very next day. 5. Chapter 25. _ Cortes sets sail with the whole squadron for the island of Cozumel, and what further took place. _ Cortes deferred the review of his troops until we should have arrived at the island of Cozumel, and gave orders for the embarking of our horses. Pedro de Alvarado, in the San Sebastian, which was a very fast sailer, was ordered to shape his course along the north coast, and his pilot received strict orders to steer direct for the Cape of St. Antonio, where all the other vessels would meet and set sail for Cozumel. Like instructions were forwarded to Diego de Ordaz. Mass having been said, the 9 remaining vessels set sail, in a southerly direction, on the 10th of February, 1519. There were 60 soldiers on board the San Sebastian, under Alvarado, among which number I was myself. Camacho, our pilot, took no notice of the orders he had received from Cortes, but shaped his course direct for Cozumel, so that we arrived 2 days earlier there than the rest. We landed our men in the same harbor I before mentioned in our expedition under Grijalva. Cortes had been detained on his passage by the breaking of the rudder of Francisco de Morla's vessel, which had to be replaced from what they had at hand. Our vessel, as I have stated above, arrived 2 days earlier at Cozumel than the rest, and the whole of the men proceeded on shore. We did not meet with a single Indian in the village of Cozumel, as all the inhabitants had fled away. Alvarado, therefore, ordered us to another village at about 4 miles distance from the latter. Here the inhabitants had likewise fled to the woods, without, however, being able to carry off all their property, so that we found numbers of fowls and other things. Of the former, Alvarado would not permit us to take more than 40. Out of a temple near at hand we took several cotton mats, and a few small boxes containing a species of diadem, small idols, corals, with all manner of trinkets made of an inferior sort of gold. We also took 2 Indians and a female prisoners, after which we returned to the village near which we had landed. In the meantime Cortes had arrived with the remaining vessels. He had scarcely stepped on shore when he ordered our pilot Camacho to be put in irons, for having followed a contrary course to what he had been ordered. But his displeasure was still greater when he learnt that the village was quite deserted, and that Alvarado had taken away, besides the fowls, the religious implements and other matters, though of little value, being half copper. Having shown no lenity to Camacho, he now also gave Alvarado an earnest reproof, telling him that it was not the way to gain the love of the inhabitants by beginning to rob them of their property. He then ordered the 2 Indians and the female whom we had taken prisoners to be brought into his presence, and put several questions to them. Mel Carrillo, whom we had captured at the promontory of Catoche, Julianillo had since died, and taken with us, perfectly understood the language of this country, and interpreted on the occasion. Cortes sent the 3 Indians to the cacique and the inhabitants, desiring them to state that they had nothing to fear from us, and to return to their village. He also restored to them the religious implements, with the golden trinkets, and gave them glass beads in exchange for the fowls, which we had eaten. Besides this, he presented each of them with a Spanish shirt. They faithfully executed Cortes's commission, for the very next day the cacique returned with the whole of the inhabitants, and so confidently did they converse with us as if they had known us all their lives. Indeed, Cortes had given peremptory orders that they should in no wise be molested. It was here also that Cortes began strict discipline, and set to work with unremitting assiduity, to which Providence lent his blessing, for everything in which he concerned himself went well, particularly with regard to making peace with the tribes or inhabitants of these countries. This the reader will find fully confirmed in the course of my history. 6. Chapter 26. _ Cortes reviews his troops, and what further happened. _ On the 3rd day after our arrival at Cozumel, Cortes reviewed the whole of his troops. Without counting the pilots and marines, our number amounted to 508 men. There were 109 sailors, and 16 horses, which were trained equally for tournaments or for war. Our squadron consisted of 11 vessels of different tonnage. Among these, one was a kind of brigantine, the property of a certain Hunes Nordis. The number of crossbowmen was 33, and of musketeers 13. Add to this our heavy guns and 4 falconets, a great quantity of powder and balls. As to the precise number of crossbowmen I cannot exactly swear, though it matters not whether there were a few more or less. After this review, Cortes ordered the artillerymen Mesa, Bartolome de Usagre, Arbenga, and a certain Catalonier whose name I forget, to keep all our firearms bright and in good order, to see that each cannon had its right-sized ball, to prepare the cartridges, and distribute the powder properly. The chief care of our gun department he confided to a certain Francisco de Oros, who had proved himself a brave soldier in the Italian wars. Juan Benitez and Pedro de Guzman had to inspect the crossbows, and see that they were supplied with two or three nuts and as many cords. They had also to superintend the exercise of shooting at the target, and the breaking in of our horses, particularly to accustom them to the noise of our firearms. I have now said sufficient of our armament. Indeed, Cortes was most particular with the merest trifles in these matters. 7 Chapter 27 _Cortes receives information that two Spaniards are in the power of the Indians at the promontory of Catoche, the steps he took upon this news. As Cortes paid attention to every circumstance, he ordered myself and Martin Camos of Biscay into his presence, and asked us what our opinion was of the word _Castilian_, which the Indians of Campeche had so often repeated when we landed there, under the command of Hernandez de Cordoba. We again informed him of every circumstance that had there taken place. He said, he had often turned this matter over in his mind, and could not help thinking but that the inhabitants must have some Spaniards among them, and he thought it would not be amiss to question the caciques of Cozumel upon this head. This Cortes accordingly did, and desired Malcarejo, who by this time had gained some little knowledge of the Spanish, and perfectly understood the language of Cozumel, to question the chiefs about it. Their several accounts perfectly corresponded, and they satisfactorily proved that there were several Spaniards in the country, whom they had seen themselves, that they served the caciques, who lived 2 days' march inland, as slaves, and that it was only a few days ago some Indian merchants had spoken with them. We all felt overjoyed at this news. Cortes told these chiefs that he would send the Spaniards letters, which they call amales in their language, in which he would desire them to come to us. The cacique and other Indians who undertook to forward these letters were most kindly treated by Cortes, who gave them all kinds of presents, and promised them more on their return. Upon which the cacique remarked to Cortes, that it would be necessary to send a ransom to the chiefs whom the Spaniards served as slaves before they would let them go. Various kinds of glass beads were therefore given to the messengers for this purpose, and Cortes sent two of the smaller vessels, armed with 20 crossbowmen and a few musketeers, under command of Diego de Ordaz, to the coast of Catoche, with orders to remain there for 8 successive days with the larger of the two vessels, and to send him information from time to time by the other vessel, while the messengers brought letters to and fro, for the distance to the promontory of Catoche from this place was only 9 miles, the whole appearing, moreover, to form but one country. The following were the contents of the letter which Cortes wrote to the Spaniards. Dear sirs and brothers, here, on the island of Cozumel, I received information that you were detained prisoners by a cacique. I beg of you to come here to me on the island of Cozumel. To this end I have sent out an armed ship, and ransom money, should it be required by the Indians. I have ordered the vessel to remain stationary off the promontory of Catoche for 8 days, to wait for you. Come as speedily as possible, you may depend upon being honorably treated by me. I am here with 11 vessels armed with 500 soldiers, and intend, with the aid of the Almighty and your assistance, to proceed to a place called Tabasco, or Petoncan, etc. With this letter the two Indian merchants embarked on board our vessel, which passed this narrow gulf in 3 hours, when the messengers with the ransom money were put on shore. After the lapse of a couple of days they actually handed over the letter to one of the Spaniards in question, who, as we afterwards learned, was called Geronimo de Aguilar, and I shall therefore in future distinguish him by that name. When he had read the letter and received the ransom money we had forwarded, he was exceedingly rejoiced, and took the latter to the cacique his master to beg for his liberation. The moment he had obtained this he went in quest of his comrade, Gonzalo Guerrero, and made him acquainted with all the circumstances, when Guerrero made the following reply. Brother Aguilar, I have united myself here to one of the females of this country, by whom I have 3 children, and am, during wartime, as good as cacique or chief. Go. And may God be with you, for myself, I could not appear again among my countrymen. My face has already been disfigured, according to the Indian custom, and my ears have been pierced. What would my countrymen say if they saw me in this attire? Only look at my 3 children, what lovely little creatures they are. Pray give me some of your glass beads for them,